The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial. I'm now here with Martin Lichtmess. Every year people tell me, I hope Martin Lichtmess is going to appear. And I'm always delighted when he does. Lichtmess is, for anyone who doesn't know, he's an Austrian writer and speaker, very good speaker, and an identitarian. But Lichtmess, why don't you introduce yourself? Oh, what's going on?
So, hello.
Hello.
Wait. You still hear me?
No. Yes, I can hear you.
Am I on the program?
Yes.
Because I have some difficulties. Seems like my browser just crashed.
Oh dear.
Wait. My browser crashed.
Bugger. That's a bit of a letdown. Sorry, everyone. I'm sure that Lichtmess will rectify the situation and be back with us soon. Let me see if I can help him. I'll take this opportunity to say that the NFT for this year, there's only 24 hours left to bid on that. So if anybody does want to do that, I'll post the link now because I am a bit concerned that that's just going to be forgotten about. Now here we go on Odyssey. There we go. That's the NFT. And I'll post it on Twitter as well. What a bummer. Okay, he's back. Let's see. Right. Hello, welcome back.
Hey, I'm back. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, yes. My compatriot, my moronic compatriot. sorry,
thank
my browser crashed.
Thank you.
There are problems with the connection a bit, but I'm here now. It's okay. Fine. I also saw you in a delay, right. So something was wrong.
Right.
So we were talking.
And are we synchronized now?
Huh? What?
Are we synchronized now?
Yes. Are we?
Good. Okay, so introduce yourself to the audience.
I'm Martin Lichtmess. I'm living in Austria, in Vienna, and I have been a writer, activist, translator for the new right scene in Austria and Germany for more than 15 years now. And I have been on Millennial now, I don't know, 6-7 times. I think 2017 was the first time, was it?
Yes,
so
it was.
That would make it, yeah. God damn, that would make it the sixth time?
The seventh time.
I'm bad in math. Right, okay, including 2017, it would be the seventh time, yes.
Yeah.
First time I was with my friend Caroline Sommerfeld. Back then we had written a book which was a sort of bestseller in our, you know, not lunatic fringe, but special interest circles. No, it went beyond that, those circles, and this was an interesting thing happening. It was called Living with Leftists and was a sort of a survival guide, you know, what to do if you're a right-wing person and you have to survive in this world, this past, you know, world. And this was the first time I was on. So, yeah, not much more to say, I guess.
Well, there is the important thing to announce that you have a Telegram channel now. And that's something that is linked below, and I hope people will follow you on there. Mm. That was an innovation this year.
I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't a friend who was, you know, pestering me every day, you know, blackmailing me emotionally, saying, set up this channel, for God's sake, and so on. Finally, I gave in to the pressure, and well, who did it.
It's good to have a friend like that.
No, I'm grateful. I'm grateful that so I got my ass moved and finally created this channel. I mean, it's bilingual now. I mean, I thought it would be a bit stupid to have two channels. I can't split up. So it's German and English equal content. So people who don't speak either language just have to deal with it. And
yeah. It's fine. I think it's fine. So I guess what we obviously want to get into your perspective of the year. I think ever since 2020, you and I have shared a concern about, well, what the hell is going on in the world? I mean, obviously before that as well, but with 2020, there was the whole COVID thing. And then the vaccine stuff the next year, and then Ukraine the year after that. What would you say, and obviously we can take this nice and slow, what would you say about the events of this year? I find it all quite baffling.
What did you find baffling in particular? Sorry for...
I was saying with Dankula before that the whole Agenda 2030 stuff just seems to have fallen away. Where for a while it was huge, they were going on about it all the time, and I'm interested in whether that's an illusion or whether it really has gone away.
Well, I guess there's still, you know, proceedings going on. I mean, what has gone down is the propaganda. It's not as big as anymore, as it was anymore. Even during 2022, when the Russian-Ukraine war was new, it has become sort of tired. Nobody seems to be quite interested in it anymore. Zelensky is not interesting anymore. He loses support from the Western elites. Also, Putin as a villain has declined. I don't see much of Putin as a villain anymore.
There was a time when people were demonizing Russia and Russian culture. Mm. There was a thing about, I think in New York, there was an auction of Russian art. And the idea was that people would destroy it. People would buy the art and then destroy it. Yeah, it was a real thing about in the middle of last year. Yeah. Specifically because of the Ukraine thing. But I guess there's this sense that the news cycle, like every year there's some big new thing. And so whatever was going on the year before just gets tossed aside like a toy. I actually saw a meme of, you know, Toy Story with the kid just dropping the old toy. And I think it was Zelensky. And yeah, there have been various memes like that. but yeah. It seems like no one is quite sure of what the situation really is in the West. And so we keep trying these different things. Would you say that's, or the elite do rather? And obviously this is not coming from ordinary people. COVID, Ukraine, and now Gaza.
Well, Gaza has grown a bit tired as well pretty soon. I thought it would be the next big current thing. but it didn't last very long, so it's still going on. Let's say horrible massacre. Nobody seems to really care. Doesn't really lead to an end. I mean, many people believe, including me, the further political aims of Israel government, or like the hardliners in Israel, are to get some sort of second 1948 done, because they need to get rid of Gaza. But I'm not, I mean, we can go into that if you like, but I just mentioned it that it seems to already have sort of lost its appeal. I don't see it so much on the media anymore. And also the other things I saw this year were rather half-hearted. I mean, at least what I could see from up close, what they were doing in Austria during the summer, they were trying to create hysteria about climate change every time the weather was a bit more hot. And I didn't see it was unusually hot for summer. I have been through hot summers before. And then the winters, I must say, in my experience, the winters have become more mild compared to when I was a child. We had huge snowfall a few months ago. But what I'm saying is that this attempt to create a hysteria every time it's more hot, which was very similar to the way they created hysteria about having a cold years ago, but it didn't really take off. Not really.
I think they want climate change to be, I think COVID was a sort of prototype for climate change. You'll get the public.
Or the other way around.
But I think they wanted to repeat that. Fear-mongering the public, getting them on board, making them aware of a bunch of concepts like social distancing and so on. And they would police themselves then. And as you say, I think people just are not interested. They just don't want another thing. What they want is stability.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also not working so well because it's more abstract. This whole climate change thing, nobody really understands how it's working. Even if you talk to skeptics, most of them will tell you they are not quite sure. Like I remember when you had on Der Schattenmacher, he's a skeptic, but he would say, yes, there may be something to it. And then he would quickly go on and talk about if it's really happening, there's nothing you can do about it. So I don't know. I mean, and it's much more direct if they tell you there's a virus going to kill you, especially you or your family or your grandparents or so. And so I guess this is why it doesn't really work, except for a few people in a political bubble. You know, those for whom climate change is a sort of religion or sort of thing they have to be afraid of. It's an obligation to be afraid of for them because it's part of their political set and all that. But it really doesn't take off, I guess.
No, I think they're going to. I think it hasn't taken off. They've struggled to make it take off. They've really struggled to get the public interest in this. And it's not the first time. They also tried it in the 2000s. And and I think they're going to continue trying, but I think it just isn't going to happen because, as you say, it's too abstract. People don't understand. I mean, they understood COVID in the sense that it's something that can get me. It's something that I might kill granny with without meaning to. They understood that. But climate change, no one can even say, well, what actually are the effects of climate change? They'll try to say something specific like, well, it will melt the polar ice caps and then it'll be water world. Kevin Costner. But everyone knows, well, anyone who looks into it knows that that's not true. There's more ice now. I actually saw a thing yesterday that there's more ice now than there was in 1978. Amazing.
Yeah, well, they also said, Here in Austria, I mean, there was this messaging that everything will dry up and the big lakes of Austria are drying up dramatically. And then we had so much rain going down, really, really a lot, rain and snow during the last weeks. And I remember 2022, which was much drier than this one. I mean, I could just tell by my own eyes that it wasn't really happening. But I saw people, some people eating it up, the suggestion. It's a sort of hypnotic suggestion. You look at something and you get this suggestion to perceive it as something threatening, as an omen, as something scary and all that.
I do think that this is partly to do with the absence of religion, that people are susceptible to something that to believe in. There's the cliche that a man who doesn't believe in God will believe in anything, and I think that's kind of true. But at the same time, there needs to be certain attributes. They can believe in equality to some extent. They can believe in COVID. Mm. But climate change is just too much. It's too weird. It's too confusing for them to grasp. So, and the other thing is that what's demanded of them is so fucking annoying. I mean, you know, it's just, ain't nobody got time for that.
I mean, also I think everybody really hates these people who glue themselves to the ground on streets, except the media. But I don't know anybody else who likes them or thinks they're doing anything useful. What really makes me want to give them Sharia punishment is when they attack paintings, even though I think it's a sort of setup in many cases, you know, that the administration of the museums let it happen because they know the paintings are protected behind glass walls. But still, the act to do it, they attack a Klimt painting in Vienna. I mean, this made me want fat posting here. Sharia like punishments. You know what Sharia like punishments are. But this is just outrageous for me.
Yeah.
To attack a beautiful painting from the past. It's just so low minded. I mean, it's they can pose. They can have this moral. They have this super moral posing, but they do disgusting things. But this is usually basic leftist stuff. You know, posing very hyper moralistic, but being very low spirited. This is what they usually are.
Yeah, I think the first time that happened, it must have been about a year ago now, where I can't remember which painting it was, but they vandalized a painting, and at first I was shocked. I was really disturbed by the idea of that happening, of that being done. And then it became clear that the painting wasn't damaged at all. It was the paint that I think they'd thrown paint on it, and it was just on the glass cover. So there was a glass thing protecting the painting. So then it happened again and again, and every time the painting itself wasn't actually damaged. So, and they must know in advance that the painting isn't going to be damaged. So, like the protesters. So then the whole thing is theatre. And then you've also got fact that as you say, the people in charge of those venues, those museums, I think it must be prearranged. I really do think it's prearranged.
Yeah.
There was a thing in
definitely.
They know, they're told this is going to happen. Don't worry about it. The painting won't be damaged anyway. But anyway, it's in a good cause. So even if it is damaged, tough. And then the people in charge of the museum. Tell the security, just let this play out. And then it does. And there's always someone to film it, although I guess that's natural nowadays. And it's one of these things that makes you think everything is just fake now. Everything is constructed. But the thing is, I think it will get to the point where, you know, real like paintings really are damaged and destroyed. It depends how far they want to take this.
Well, I mean, these are really invaluable paintings. They attacked Botticelli's. I think the Spring Primavera by Botticelli and others. These are invaluable paintings. I don't think museums would take any risks. They get damaged, and these people would also be, let's say, too cowardly in the end. Because they would have to pay compensation. Or, I mean, there was one particular incident. There was an attack on the Rockaby Venus by Velázquez, which is a nude from the 17th century. And more than 100 years ago, it was attacked by a suffragette, you know, these early feminists out of protest. So it was a proto-woke bitch who had a knife and she ripped the canvas. So she really, really damaged it. It was a serious damage on the painting, and it was eventually restored. When you see it today, I saw it in Vienna. I think it's in London. I'm not sure about that now, but it was in Vienna someday, and I saw it, and you can slightly see it. And this was attacked again now, but you know, one of those fake protests. I mean, I wonder if I had more respect if they would actually do such a thing and destroy it. I'm not sure about that. I mean, my surrealist face is gone. So I remember reading autobiography of Luis Buñuel, one of my favorite directors, the Spanish film director, who was a surrealist, and he would talk about how he just doesn't care about bombing museums and so on. This was a different generation, and he would talk about how he much hated the painting Guernica by his compatriot Picasso, and he said, "This is just a fucking propaganda painting. Just burn it." I mean, there's some stuff I wouldn't care either, which has been canonized. But I'm digressing here a bit. I mean, the thing we should talk about is probably the fake, the feeling of everything's fake. Yes, it is indeed. Today I saw a really ridiculous poster. I have made a photo, but cannot show you now. It was some advertisement in the subway, at the tram station, right? And it showed a rather androgynous looking woman with short hair. I don't know, very plain woman. I mean, she was, white or kind of white, I would say. And in the back, there was a landscape and it had these wind wheels. Have you seen them? They're used to generate energy from wind.
Oh, yes.
Do you have those in?
Yeah.
Do you have those in Britain?
Yes. Dalrymple calls them eco-crucifixes.
Yeah, my God. These are things. This is one of the horrible things they have ever done. If you go through landscapes, I have been traveling in Germany. I was up in northern Germany, in forests at the Elbe, and sometimes you look on the horizon and you see these like cyclopic giants. They are standing there and just, you know, and the thing is they almost do nothing. Also, they destroy the view of the landscape massively because they are huge, they are ugly, they are monstrous. They don't generate that much energy. And also they shred birds and insects. So they are not very ecological at all. It's just a fucking scam. It's one of the things that makes me really, really, really angry when I see them. And and on this poster, you see this woman, this androgynous woman in front of the, I wouldn't even say androgynous. It was like a sexless woman, a sexless creature.
And not quite white either. So sexless and raceless.
Yeah. Well, she was white, but she could also have been more like from Mediterranean parts, and so
okay.
You see, and then it said diversity, climate change, climate protection, and a third thing which I forgot now, which was equally preposterous. And it was this is Europe, you are Europe. It said you are Europe. It was so weird. It was that this is what Europe, the idea of Europe, is supposed to be about. To be this, not interesting, bland, rootless, sexless creature in front of these horrible things, which are just the opposite of what they claim to be. Yeah? They are not good for the environment. I mean, I have read they are just cutting down forests in Germany just to erect this fucking stuff. I mean, I apologize to your viewers for cursing so much, but this gets me really heated up because this is a crime, an absolute crime. I mean, if I would be in charge someday, I will maybe this will be the first thing to do to cut down this shit, you know. And I heard they did it in France; they cut down some of those, so you can do it. They can be removed someday, yeah.
And this is an important thing to remember that these things can be taken down, and ugly buildings can be demolished. And beautiful buildings can be restored. It's important to bear that in mind.
Mm-hmm. They built up the Frauenkirche in Dresden, the church in Dresden, which was destroyed in the war. They built it up as it was. Looks wonderful. Also, in Berlin, there was the Stadtschloss. It was a palace in Berlin, and it was torn down after the war, and instead there was this building of the Stasi, and it was just one of the most horrible buildings you'd ever see, made for a horrible purpose. Now it was like the state Stasi police, and fortunately they tore it down and they built up the palace, but only on the exterior. So inside it's different than it used to be, but the facade and the outside looks like the original, and you can do that if you want to, and it looks good. So there's no excuse not doing it. But just to get back at this poster I saw, this was so fascinatingly preposterous. I think I have to write something about it. But this is what they are selling us, and I always wonder.
I hope you use that phrase. You've got to use that phrase in it.
Which
fascinatingly
one?
Preposterous.
I mean, who the fuck are they talking to? Who are they addressing to? It's just a ritual. Or I tell you another thing about posters I saw. I mean, right in front of me, I see this messaging. So there is this campaign in Vienna now, which is about violence against women, And I think it's also preposterous on many levels. I mean, I believe there's violence against women, but I think if you would look closer into it, the majority of it, you know, would be, I guess, some sort of ethnic background or ethnic thing and so on.
Oh, for sure.
And there's always, and there's also this messaging that, you know, men are always the perpetrators, women are always the victims, women are always innocent. I mean, it's just a sort of ritual to, I don't think it does help anything about the issue. I think it's just a messaging to create this image that women are a special victim group. And you have all the preposterous posters of left-wing politicians. One of us, particular, there was one where this female politician, she's looking like this at you. And then in the background, you see a sort of superimposition of her face, and she's looking that way and that way. And you don't know why. And the message of the poster was, believe women. Okay, right, I understand. So, and they try to address it to men, but also in a very awkward way. And one of the worst things I saw was you could see a biceps, a male biceps, you know, like really muscular, and a tattoo on it. And the tattoo was so absurd. It was a heart, and in the heart it said, respect women. Respect women. Huh? And the message was like, guys, be real man, respect women. Huh? Then you are a real man. And I said, what the fuck? And the greatest things when I see these posters is when they are combined with other posters, a bit like in a movie montage. So there was this poster, and on the other side of that tram station, I always look at tram station posters, there was another poster, and it was so disgusting. It was about some food delivery service. And you could see a guy who was a sort of Kalergi mystery meat humanoid creature, and he had this this comfy coat on, you know, with a unicorn head, you know, like look. And he's sitting there, and he has some disgusting pizza. He has a slice of pizza And while he's in front of a computer and he has a video game on, and he's like, ah!
Oh, and, my and he, God!
Yeah. Yeah. And then below you can see a credit card with an American name, and it's just an advertisement. Use this pizza delivery service really easy. Just a click, and you don't have to move your ass while you are gaming. You just get it delivered, and you can sit there in your stupid comfy suit and get fat and look ugly. And it was just the antithesis. You know, the masculinity was on the other poster. And yeah. It was used for a strange messaging, yeah, like saying, real men respect women, you know. In the background, you see this completely castrated, racially mixed, whatever person who's just like, you know, the dream of Yuval Harari, the future is the future. You know? Millions of people will be like this. They will be living in their pods, and they will be doing nothing else but having video games and getting the food delivered by drones or whatever.
And dressing like, just, so he's wearing a
dressing like that, yeah. Dressing like that.
Yeah.
Completely emasculated, you see.
Yeah.
And the combination of these posters was just stunning. It was so telling. It was so telling about what's going on. But in longer, I mean, think this, there was another, I can tell you about another one, which was also equally stupid. They wanted to have also, it was a message directed at men. And you would always see a dude on, there were different posters on the series. It was a series. And there was always a dude, and he was looking straight at you, yeah, in this disapproving way, right? And different kinds of dudes. One would be Asian, one would be some kalergi person. I really love this term, kalergi person now. I picked it up somewhere. There was a football team. There was just some regular white dude. And they're looking at you like this confrontational, you know. And then there's a line like, hey, leave that girl alone. Don't you see she don't like what you do? Or have you ever listened to yourself, how you talk to your girlfriend? Yeah. Or the football team, you know, three guys in the football team, and they look at you and they say, you know, this is not okay with us if you treat women badly. It was so utterly moronic. It was incredible. It was almost a parody, you know. It was fantastically comical. And yeah. I thought, whoever designs these posters, do they really think it has an effect on anybody? Huh? Any man passes by and says, yeah, this dude is right, you know, I shouldn't cat whistle a woman, or, you know, I shouldn't gaze at her legs, or some migrant, you know, who's molesting women. You said, oh, these dudes are right, you know, and I want to be one of them. I want to be a cool dude.
Yeah, it will have, the thing is, it will have an effect. And on the migrants, it will have a different effect. It will make them think that we are just cucks. We are
pussies.
Just
cucks.
But on white men, I think it does have an effect. And
yeah,
it's sort of
what
castrating.
What kind of effect do you think?
I think it castrates white men. I think it makes them think, okay, so basically my job here on Earth, the point of me is to respect, is to help and facilitate women and respect women and take them seriously. And really, that's it.
I'm a white knight watchdog. Be a white knight watchdog.
A male feminist. Which is really one of the lowest life forms. I mean, I despise any guy who is a male feminist. I think there's something seriously wrong with them. And if it happens naturally, there's something very wrong with them. But the culture tries to make it happen artificially. The culture tries to make men into male feminists. You know, obviously, we can all say it's wrong to abuse women. Of course it is. But this goes far beyond that. They're trying to inculcate an obsession in men with this matter, with respecting women. And
right.
I think the result is the Well, it's an imbalance, and it demotes men in their own society, in their own minds, actually. But at the same time, they're getting rid of the gender binary. And this is a huge contradiction in our society now, that they want to be, they're obsessed with women, but at the same time, they can't answer the question, what is a woman? And this is why, whatever you think about Matt Walsh, that was a very good title. I think the documentary was good as well, but I think the title, it is a genuine question. Nobody, none of these people can say what a woman is. And then that brings me to a question that's something that I wanted to bring up to you. About a month ago, 2 months ago, there was a water fountain in Vienna created to memorialize, the thing, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to put it up on screen just so that other people can see it.
Beware, people. You can never unsee it again. If you want to save yourself from trauma, look away now.
I should say beforehand that I didn't know that there is a connection between Vienna and Cultus Clarus Wasser until water. They have these incredible water, cold water fountains around the city. The water comes from the Alps, and this was all, it's a thing. It's wonderful in the summer because I was in Vienna in the summer with Lichtmess. We met up. It was a very good time. And he introduced me to these. And it goes back, 100, 200 years? How long ago was it?
About 150 years or so.
Yeah, that's what I thought, 150.
Yeah.
And so to celebrate this, this system being installed in the city 150 years ago, to celebrate that, this monument has been created. And here it is.
Dear God. Sorry, I just freaked out. No, this is it's moronic. It's absolutely moronic. It's like your drooling retard who designed this, and these are all retard creatures. Look at these,
at
these limbs. You know, this deformed, weak, ugly,
sickly.
Freakishly, inhuman, it's not human.
And
I don't know, it looks made up.
Yeah. You can't even tell whether they're male or female. And so this is what I was getting at a few minutes ago, that they're destroying the idea of male and female. And the result, I mean, yes, there is androgyny, which is sort of elegant, but they rarely go for that. It's something like this. It's something
sexless,
fucking awful like this, where it's freakish and looks ill. And I mean, it looks like I don't know if anyone's seen The Fly 2, which ends with this guy, this mutant creature, and that's basically what these figures look like. And
I guess you can remove the picture now, because
but my point was, this is what's again and again, and it's not just one thing like that. It's very common now, very common. So it cannot be accidental. There's some reasoning behind this, and I think it is part of destroying male and female as concepts in society.
Yes, I mean, I see a similar thing going on in that poster, I Am Europe, I described to you. And Europe is about this being a sexless creature who likes these windmills and who is all for diversity and climate protection. It's all very shallow. And compared to these other posters, I told you the only time they are using masculinity in advertisements are when it's used in such a way that these dude bros look at you and say, this is serious, man, you know, treat your woman right, huh? Or the biceps and so, which is perverse. You know, it's using the masculine image to undermine masculinity in a perverse way. As you said, introduce feelings of guilt, make everybody a white knight or so, I mean, I'm not sure whether people really take it serious. It may have some subliminal effect.
Yeah, I think they do. I think that not guys, not men in their 30s or 20s, but I think teenage boys will take it seriously. Certainly the more intelligent or the more sort of cerebral of them will think, okay, that's what I'm to do. That's what I'm to be. I think it will have an effect. And then you'll have the guys in their 20s who are very social, and they will take it seriously as well, because they'll assume, well, okay, that's what I've got to do in order to be popular. That's what I've got to say. Yeah. That's what I've got to go along with. I mean, guys say all sorts of retarded things. They go along with all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, it will have an effect. I don't think this is something that just people see it and just forget about it. If that were the case, they'd stop doing it because it's a waste of time.
Yeah, I hope you are not right. I mean, I have to think that it's sometimes I think when I see these preposterous posters that they are sort of a masturbatory thing. It's like a ritual. It's designed by people in a bubble who really believe this kind of shit, and they are putting out these messages, and probably nobody looks at it even anymore. So I'm slightly more optimistic that it doesn't have really that much of an effect. I mean, I also see that people are probably paying less attention to this shit than I do. I see it more than others. I mean, most people are like sunk deep in their smartphones, and they don't look at these posters or these screens in the subway anymore. I mean, in Vienna and the trams, we also have this little screens which feed you propaganda all the time, and they have been around for about 20 years now, but I don't see people looking at them except for me. I look at them, and then I get this Tourette syndrome, like
sarcastic rage.
So I get this, I read this and I say, we need some climate protection, sure. And I start mumbling and talking to myself, and people think I'm just a lunatic. Wish I am. But the fountain is so, I mean, honestly, think about it. It brings literally tears to my eyes because it's so unspeakably moronic. The people who have decided it, you know, they just should never, ever have a decision like this. And the people who have made it, I lack words to describe this utter thing. And did we talk about it last year? I don't know. But there's a different thing that one of the people responsible for building this water supply in Vienna, which is famous, we are very proud of it.
Right, this is awful. Just before you go on to that, I'll say that I saw something about the company who made this sculpture.
Yeah,
whatever.
Okay,
so and they've done similar stuff elsewhere. So it's obviously something that they do. It's their business. You know, I mean, it's not a one-off.
So it's anyway, same, yeah. So it's this, the same so, style.
Yeah. Oh, I think
this is their shtick, their trademark.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
What's happening?
No, nothing. I think it's fine. It stuttered. But anyway, you want to tell the audience about the statue in Vienna. So go into that.
Sorry, I was a bit distracted. I looked something up. So, yes, there's this famous mayor of Vienna, Karl Lueger, at the end of the 19th century, during what many consider the golden age of, or the golden age of late Habsburg Vienna. Also this, you know, kind of elegant decadence. And so this is when the city was on a level with Paris or London or so. And Karl Lueger was a mayor at the time, and he was also responsible for having this idea to get the water from the Alps to Vienna. And so they built this water supply. And he also did many good things for Vienna. I mean, undoubtedly, he was a very, very important figure. And if you look at the art that was built at that time, this is still something people want to look at. You know, Vienna, 1900, 1890s, or before. Yeah? This is what the face of Vienna is mostly. Yeah? Some things are way older, you know, like St. Stephen's Dome. But this is how the modern Vienna was created in the middle of the 19th century. And it's just beautiful to behold. You have been there. You go with a tram around Ringstraße, and then you can see all the things they built back then. There's the opera house, there's the theater, there's Hofburg, which is way older, there's the parliament, the university, all these things. And so, yeah. And there's a monument dedicated to Karl Lueger, and it's also, I think, 19th century or a bit later. And it's a, you know, it's a statue, a heroic statue with lots of figures adorning it. And it's a beautiful monument, if you look at it. It's a beautiful monument, and he's an important figure. But the problem people have with him is that he was, let's say, sort of anti-Semitic, in a way that, you know, he would appeal to anti-Semitic sentiments back then in a populist way. But in practice, he was very mild and lenient. He had this.
Yeah, this it famous... sounds like he was anti-Semitic in the way that Berlusconi was racist.
I never thought of that. Yes.
Yes. He said,
okay. This is a good.
Yeah.
What did you say? Do you have a quote?
Berlusconi said that it was something like, we don't want any immigrants. We're going to close the borders. We're not going to let anyone in. Except for the pretty girls.
Yeah, sure. There's the old school Italian macho boomer humor.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, you could say Lueger was more in a way like this. I mean, there were also you know, Jews in his government, or Jews friendly to him, and he would famously say, "I decide who's a Jew." You see. So the good Jews were not Jews. They were okay Jews. So this was the way it was handled. Also remember, this was also a golden age for Jews in Vienna back then, for the Jewish, you know, poets, literati. Sigmund Freud was there. So the Jews were fine in Vienna at that time, absolutely fine. And they contributed much to the culture. And so, you know, but Adolf Hitler, he liked Lueger, he praised him, except for not being German nationalist enough. This is a criticism they had about him. And this praise goes on that they are bitching about Lueger for years now, for decades probably. They changed the name of streets. And this monument, they wanted to take it down for a long time now. And they had plans to sort of, first, what are you going to do about it? Then you need to have some explanationary plate that says, okay, caution, don't worship this guy too much because he did evil, stupid thing, said evil things. And now what they're trying to do is...
This is so grotesque. I want people to listen closely to this because it's so grotesque. There's this statue to this mayor of Vienna from 100 years ago, and he said some things that could be seen as anti-Semitic. So here's what they want to do to this statue.
Yeah, but and also he's one of the most important figures for Vienna. The way Vienna looks now, this was under why he was mayor. So he did lots of good things for the city. He was a great figure in Austrian history. No question about that. You want to show them what they're going to do? Have you got a picture?
No, I haven't, but I can find one.
But what they're going to do is now, they want to, must help me with the words now, they want to twist it and make it stand slanted. Is this the word? So.
Yes, they want to tilt it slightly, just so that he's not,
tilted.
So that it's not vertical, so that he, so as to degrade him.
Yeah. So just to degrade him, to make the monument look ugly. And it costs thousands and thousands of euro. It's very expensive to do that. Very expensive to do that. And some genius so-called artist came up with this idea. And it has been discussed for 10 years now. Up to now, the administration of Vienna, fortunately, was saying, yeah, no, no, no. But now they are finally ready for it. All right, you saw it.
Yeah, you see? This is our plan of how it will look. So this, I mean, this is absolutely fucking unforgivable. And I will not Fed post by saying what I would do to anyone responsible for this. But I don't need to, because any decent person would feel the same way. I mean, this is purely because he said a few things that he wasn't entirely in full throated support of Jews. That's it. And it's 100 years ago.
He was critical. I say he was critical of some Jews, not even all of them. And the Jews did well during his reign. Yeah, so, but it wasn't really the most important thing he ever did. Yeah, he did much more important things. And also, look at this. This is a very nice monument from turn of the century. Very lovely to look at, and it's also deserved for an important figure. And there's this kind of, you know, revenge to it. You know, this will of destruction and of distorting things. And it's so incredibly mean spirited. And now, if you juxtapose it with that atrocious fountain they made, I don't know which makes me more angry. This is on an equal level. Both these are crimes, but they are complementary. They belong together.
I think this is worse. I think this statue is
The statue is worse. You think? Yeah.
Because I mean, that fountain thing is just ugly. It's just stupid and silly. Oh. This is taking something that's beautiful and deliberately subverting it and ruining it. Mm. And as you say, they want to spend. It will cost a lot of money to do this, but they want to actually spend this money to do this. It's just astounding.
And the money, where the fuck does it come from?
Yeah, well, it'll come from the
taxpayer Vienna. Money. They're taking my taxpayer money. I mean, this is insane how much they take, even from people who are independent like me. I mean, just they leave nothing. They leave just nothing. I mean, they rob you of everything, and then they spend it for doing atrocious things like this. Yeah, I guess this is even worse than the ugly fountain, because it's also an attack on history, attack on the past. It would be less horrible if they just did, okay, we have a beautiful thing from the past, and we also make an ugly thing from the present. But they cannot leave the past alone. They cannot leave as it is.
No.
The past also has to be attacked and erased. And
also that they know they're doing this. They know that this is meaningful to the people of Vienna. Yeah. Like, this is just bullshit. And they're insulting the water, which is, it does matter. But I think this matters more. And that's why they're doing it. And as you said, there's an artist who's been literally campaigning to do this for more than a decade.
Yes.
It's probably incredible. The most important. He's basically dedicated his life to getting this legislation passed.
How pathetic can you be? Oh, what a pathetic kind of human being can you be if you want to do that?
Yeah? Absolutely loathsome.
Absolutely. The lowest scum. You see, this is I'm glad you this is something I can work myself up really, really hard.
So can I. Crimes.
You see, I love it that you have the same
sentiment. The first time you told me about this, I think we spent about half an hour just swearing at each other over Telegram, over audio.
I'm glad it wasn't recorded. It wasn't. Yeah, I hope it wasn't recorded.
Maybe by MI5.
No. I mean, this is one of the deepest connection I can have with people if they feel about these things like I do, because they really, really hit me hard. And the thing is, what makes us so angry is there's nothing you can do about it. You feel all this talk they have about democracy. And recently there was another campaign poster where you had the fat present mayor of Vienna. It's just a fat guy. His face looks famously like a schnitzel, you know, Wiener Schnitzel. and his face looks just like that, and he's this little dumb creature, and he was also responsible for keeping up COVID rules long after they had ceased in all parts of Vienna, all parts of Austria, but only in Vienna you still had to wear masks. These rules went on until spring and even, I think, summer of 2022. And this guy was responsible for it. He's just an absolute loathsome creature. And I saw a poster where you see his schnitzel face, and it says Zusammenhalt zählt, also, which means like solidarity counts, you know, we are sticking together. And he looks at some citizen with a very he has this fake look. So, oh, yes, I'm very empathic with you. Yes, I'm very concerned. The fuck he is. I mean, he was responsible for terrorizing people, for forcing people to get their children vaccinated. And he's also responsible for atrocious shit happening under his rule. I mean, unlike under Luega's rule, lots of good things happened for Vienna, and his rule just shit happened, you know? And this is just shit. I'm getting worked up again. But you see how bad it is. And this is also this another example of this fake world, this fake unreal world, where they're spending lots of money to create these atrocious things.
Yeah. I mean, it's just dreadful. It's bad enough. Like, decline is bad enough, but decline that is actually paid for and designed and desired.
By my money. I'm a taxpayer. By my money. My money pays for it. I didn't vote for the guy. I'm not solidaric. He's not solidaric with me. I'm not solidaric with him. I think he should be sent to North Korea to... I mean, he's a socialist, so he deserves to live in a socialist state. So go to hell. Sorry. Sometimes it feels so good. It feels so good to hate. Sometimes it's healthy. it's the only thing you can do when you are helpless, seeing all destroyed, what's beautiful and noble and right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what else can you do?
See, this is why I think you should have your own live stream. Like a regular thing where you talk about this stuff.
I just go hate rants for hours, you know, 6 hours, just the Carl Luego. And did you know, I mean, it had been under attack by Antifa groups before. Because, of course, when it was in the media again, the media said, ooh, this is a problem. Lots of Antifa people probably had no idea. They don't know shit about history. And so they would spray slogans on the monument and damage it. And some groups of identitarians, they set up a night watch. It was mostly symbolic because you cannot do it all the time. One day they will come and will put their spray paint on it. But at least it was a thing identitarians did 1 or 2 years ago, can't remember exactly, to protect the monument. And of course they would frame it and say, ooh, they're protecting the alleged anti-Semitism, but it's about much more than that. I mean, there's also this thing that you measure people from the past with today's very rotten standards, with woke standards. And by these standards, what will be left? I mean, almost every person that lived before 1950 will not hold up to these standards. They could snare just about everyone and everything. And where would you stop?
Absolutely, because they were all racist, literally. Yeah. They were racist in a way that it was effortless.
Because they simply
The word is retarded, but you know what I mean. Yeah. They had in-group preference effortlessly. Mm-hmm. They didn't want foreigners swamping into their land. That would have been incredible to them. By today's standard, like, they would be called racist today. Virtually everyone from 100 years ago would be today called
racist. They had pride in their culture. They had pride in their culture. They believed in the superiority of the culture, mostly. And also... the views, I mean, about almost everything we have today were just different. I mean, you can even say, oh yes, fortunately things have changed ever since then, but at least then you should have the what, how should I say?
Humility to realize that things
Yes, the humility to say these are different people, these are different ages. Yeah? I mean, and also if you have great artists or historical figures who have flaws, it's just an insane sort of hygiene, a weird sort of hygiene. And just a hatred for the past.
I think there is a lot of that. Partly because we...
Look, I have a cigar. I have a cigar now.
Oh, right. Somebody was asking earlier. There was a super chat about the pipe you were smoking.
I have two kinds. I have this one today. And I have prepared them in advance, then this one. And now I'm going over to have the cigar.
Ah, well, let me read this super chat to you.
Mm-hmm.
The geezer said, Hello, Mr. Lifmes. I'm also smoking my pipe while watching the stream. I'm smoking some Samuel Goweth skiff mixture. What tobacco are you smoking? And what pipe are you smoking? I'm very fond of Vaughan pipes and have a nice collection.
Mm.
So what kind of tobacco
Well, I have it here in my bag. I can show you. Remember, you don't have a vape today. I thought you would have one to lose it and search for it on the... Ah, here you are. Here is it. Sorry. So this is the one I'm using right now. Borkum Riff. Huh? But I have different ones. This is another one. This is a Scottish blend, Redfords. Called, but I must say I'm not super.
Yeah, can you super hold that discerning up again so that people can see it?
Okay. I'm not very discerning about this. I try different kinds each time.
Ah, right. Okay. All right.
So don't think I'm a specialist or a connoisseur. Probably the guy who asked me the question is much more than I am. I just enjoy it casually.
Right. That's okay. It. And what about the cigar?
Oh, this is Dannemann tubes. They're in tubes. They're just nice, relaxing.
Yes. I got a cigar. Gosh, it was in New York, when I was in New York. And I think I still had it. I think I actually ended up smoking it about 2 years later. in London. very strange. I don't know how that happened.
I don't smoke these often.
All right.
And I like to smoke for the effect on screen, like in the old Hollywood movies, when Marlene Dietrich was always smoking because it looks so good in black and white. And she has this... In old Hollywood movies, they're always smoking. I like that because it has good visual effects in black and white. So...
Yeah, I'm just thinking about Blade Runner there because I've got a photo from that where she's smoking. But of course, yeah, it was definitely very, very prevalent. I don't know. It's hold on a second. Let me see. Okay. Right. Here's some sort of anime version of it. Sorry, I don't know.
Oh, yes. Nice. Yeah, nice. This film has it takes from film noir. The lightning is from film noir, you know, the 1940s, 50s crime movies. And in this year also her haircut is a bit 40-ish, you see. So it's conscious in that film, this film noirish lightning. It's like a sci-fi neo noir, and smoking does a lot. It's also very often you can see in these kind of films. Yeah, because it has this nice visual effects.
Yes. Yeah, do you
also
prefer
in color,
her?
I mean, this film is...
Huh? Do you prefer her or Pris?
Honestly, I prefer her.
Yeah. Right, okay. Sean Young, not Pris.
I mean, Pris is also nice. I mean, I like them both. They're different types and so. But I think you would believe, because I'm a gothic person, you would believe I like the other better. But I like this one better. I mean, I don't like artificial style so much anymore, so I like her better.
Yes, and she's.
I mean, she's
class.
Artificial in both are artificial in the movie.
But both
are not real women. They are artificial women.
Replicants. That's true. But Chris is obviously the crazier one. BPD.
Yeah, it's certainly an eye catcher. Looks good, but yeah.
I'd buy that for a dollar. Anyway, we should get back to talking about cultural decline because that's what people want us to talk about.
Yeah, they want to talk about decline. We don't and hours of ranting about decline.
So, I know. I would feel bad if we just talked about hot chicks.
Both holes and, I don't know, Miss chicks or so.
No, I wouldn't do that.
To maybe get back where we started. The fake world thing. Also, we have also this terrible chancellor who has been in charge ever since COVID. He was there during the worst time of COVID, when the government announced they want to push a general vaccination mandate, mandatory vaccination for everybody. This was really bad. It soured lots of people. And before that, he was Minister of the Interior, and he was responsible for suppressing the protests. His Karl Nehammer is his name, and I really hate his guts. He's also such a disgusting person. And one thing I find so striking is he always looks like that. Even when he smiles, he has his teeth clenched.
That's very unfortunate.
Look it up. Look at the photos. It's so disgusting. This one just slightly protruded.
Oh dear.
And
And what's his name?
No, this is a really Karl Nehammer. He's the Chancellor of Austria right now.
I'll find.
And just a terrible person. So I just flipped through. Pointless interview he gave to the biggest tabloid paper in Austria, Kronenzeitung, and I just saw the headline and says, extremism is growing in this country on all sides. You know, the story like they say, ooh, there's right-wing, far-right extremism, there is Islamist extremism, there's leftist extremism. Only one who's not extremist is the government. The government who terrorized us for 2 years with this insane stuff. They are not extremists. They're just all in the reasonable center, and they're just criminals. That's what they are. So I thought this talk about extremism has become so preposterous. Also, the way they, we had some trouble with Islamists in Austria. There was even a terror attack in late 2020, in November 2020. It was a bit belated after the series. So there's trouble here, but they're always putting identitarians who warned against these things, who are agitating against importing Islam. Yeah, there he is. You see the way he clenches his teeth? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all the
this
time.
This is exactly what I mean. Yeah.
Weird looking guy.
I mean, look at this disgusting guy. Always like this, always clenching his teeth like this. Yeah. Yeah.
That's very strange.
Well, my hate for the government and these kind of people. There's also been a story, I should mention it briefly. So there was this guy, Pilnacek was his name. He was also Minister for the Interior years ago. And he was one of those responsible for hunting down identitarians. They had these trials in 2018, I think, huge trial. They did nothing else but setting up stickers and posters, for example, on a building of the Green Party. And so nothing else, just some propaganda, such as some protest. And there was a group of them put on trial. Eventually they were acquitted, but the state really tried to crush them. And this guy, Pilnacek was his name, he was behind it. And this guy now mysteriously died. They say he committed suicide. I won't go into the details. There was a thing that he had taken away his license from the police because he was driving too fast or so. But I have to tell you, the story is extremely fishy. And after he was dead, there was a tape resurfacing. Somebody had recorded in secret. Somebody who didn't like him. They met in some noble restaurant in Vienna, and this guy had some chips on his shoulders against him. He was from former Freedom Party guy or so, and he recorded secretly the conversation. And in this conversation, he alludes to corruption in the party he's from, ÖVP, the center-right party, which is ruling Austria right now. Nehammer is also ÖVP. The center-right, the fake conservatives, the conservatives, which are, in my opinion, much worse than the genuine leftists or socialists. You know? They're just the scum of the earth. They are the mafia in Austria. They're so corrupt. They rule everything. They have their hands in lots of business deals. And there had been investigations against them at that time when Kickl, who's now head of Freedom Party, was the Minister of the Interior. And this was during the administration when Strache, Freedom Party, was vice chancellor, and Kurz, Sebastian Kurz, he was chancellor. And you remember the story, Strache was shut down because some scandal, blah, blah. But the thing is, my theory is that the guy they really wanted to get was Kickl, because Kickl is a brilliant man, and he was on a position they really hated, because usually ÖVP wants to have this position of Minister of the Interior, and they want to have control of the BVT, it's sort of the like in Germany, protection of the constitution. This kind of guy, the inland secret service,
internal security,
Those that go, for example, after alleged extremists and so, right? These kind of people. And what Kickl did, there were raids at the party center of the ÖVP, because I'm shortening the story now, I don't want to get too much into it, but because there were doubts about corruption going on and fishy things, so they wanted Kickl to be gone, right? And they eventually succeeded now by shooting down this government back then with this scandal. And now, to go back today, there's this guy Pilnacek. He eventually killed himself, which I don't believe it. And on this tape that resurfaced, that one big shot of the ÖVP, he threatened him to not go after ÖVP party corruption, because at least he had some sense of justice, honor, duty, and he allegedly wanted to investigate, in his own party. And they told him not to. They even threatened him not to do it. And this is now open, and Sobotka is the big shot. Forget all these names, I guess you won't remember them. But I just want to tell you that this is one example about the swamp that's going on here on corruption, untrustworthy people, a real mafia. They're connected to money, to industrialists. They're buying ads in the paper. They do all kinds of things, and they are there pretending, oh, we are fighting extremists, we are democracy, we are blah, blah, blah. Nothing what they say is of any worth. It's just...
Well, it's very similar to the situation in America, where they're always talking about the threat from white supremacists and the far right and so on. But meantime, the mainstream, the institutions, the establishment, the DC swamp, is utterly corrupt. I mean, it's monstrously corrupt. So that, but they distract people from that by talking about the threat from the far right and so on. It's very similar.
And they are in Britain, to
an extent.
And also what they do is, we talked about it before, they are implementing extremist policies. I think mass migration, as they do it, is an extremist policy. It's a radical extremist policy, changing the fabric of the country forever, if it turns out. Or the way they pursued the COVID policies was absolutely insane, extremist policies. Yeah? And also the pushing other agendas, which people got used to much more, you know, like gender mainstreaming, as we call it. And so it's just a projection. If you talk about extremism, you always have to have a standard. What in relation to what thing is it extreme to? Yeah, extremism is not a thing that exists in relationless space. It's a relational concept. Yeah? So in order to say something extreme, you have to have a measure what is not. Yeah? And this is completely turned upside down. So that people that say, look, we want to have a normal country, we don't want to have people persecuted because they don't take a vaccine. They are now the radicalists. They are the terrorists. So
this is what I've been seeing this quite a lot recently. That I don't see myself as an extremist. I don't see you as an extremist. I don't see Martin Selner.
I don't know so much about myself.
Well, the trouble is that
joke aside, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the world that you want, I don't see as some wild, it's just, you know, it's just Vienna from 50 years ago. It's the same with me, Britain from 100 years ago, or something like that. It's not some wild idea. It's not something that is extreme, it is radical, and so on. Mm-hmm. But the situation that they want is extreme. I mean, they literally want to transform our countries out of recognition. How the fuck can you advocate that and call yourself a moderate? I mean, it's incredible. Obviously, it's a total lie, but they get away with it because they know how to package this. So it's an inversion of reality where the people who just want a sane society are the extremists. The people who want to transform everything are the moderates. And I think one day people are going to look back on this. I'm really interested in how is this period going to be seen in history? Because in so many ways it is perverse. And
upside down. It's an upside down world.
Yeah.
Foul is fair and fair is foul. Like as the witches in Shakespeare say. So, I don't think there's something extremist, for example, to say let's build a good-looking fountain and not these distorted, horrible, limb, lifeless creatures, you know, deformed creatures or so. But this is the new normal. I mean, this was one of the words that was coined during the COVID era, the new normal. And we get to, there are many new normals we are supposed to get used to all the time. And the media is doing the brainwashing to get people into ever new normals. And it seems like almost boundless what they can do.
The new normal.
I mean, I guess there are limits. There are limits. It's not boundless. Well, I just scratched that. I mean, there are limits. You could see COVID had its limits. The climate change policy had its limits. I know about the migration thing because, I mean, you see in France and other countries, insane acts of violence have happened and happen all the time. Just insane. I can't look at this anymore. And I also find it very depressing. I mean, Martin Selner does it quite a lot on his channel. He has this, I call it atrocity messaging, that he has very detailed accounts of the latest atrocities committed by some migrant in somewhere in Europe. I mean, it's all over Europe. Children are getting killed. Women are getting raped. It's just one atrocity after another. And I personally find it
depressing. I think that you and I are more sensitive to this kind of thing. It gets us down. Whereas someone like Selner is more resilient. He can put up with it. So I think that it probably doesn't depress him so much, even though he cares about it very much. But I don't think it will depress him.
He cares a lot about it. It works him up, but he believes it will people make wake up in a rage. But the problem is, his channel is now very limited. They have cut down all his platforms, and people who perceive him are now already he's preaching to the choir, as they say. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you will not.
Yeah.
You, exactly. You don't need any more detailed atrocity stories to get people convinced that some kind of
it's pointless to share stuff like that on Telegram. Because the only people on Telegram are us. So we already know it's a very bad situation.
Sure.
If you're on Twitter, and, there's more reason to do it. But
The thing is, you want normies to see it. Yeah, I mean, I understand if you say, let's shock normies into red pill normies by shocking them. And because the media keeps this silent. I mean, media does report about it, but, you know, they try to keep it down and not make a big fuss of it, and goes on and on and on and on and on. So I don't think it's such a good idea, because also for me, I mean, I follow Martin's channel and others like this, and then I say, I can't make this unseen now what I have seen again. I don't want to see it. I don't want to cancel the channel, because I want to follow other news, but then I have to see this shit, and I don't need anymore. Because I don't need to be convinced anymore that this is bad and some sort of migration stop or remigration thing should happen, or something should be done about this, you know, criminals and so.
Of course,
so, yeah.
Everyone knows it should, something should be done. I guess that brings us to an interesting topic that's come up on Millennial an awful lot this year, especially at the start of it. A lot of people were talking about Twitter and Elon Musk. And I don't want to go over that again, but I want to hear your opinion about this from an Austrian perspective, because it seems that I was reinstated, Morgoth was reinstated, a few people, not everyone, but a few people from Britain were reinstated. But that hasn't happened with Austrians. What do you think is going on there?
No idea, frankly. I mean, I haven't been reinstated. I have appealed 6 or 7 times. Also, half of the time, as I appealed before Elon was there, I appealed after Elon was there several times. They don't let me in anymore. And they cut me down for completely preposterous reasons. It was like some sort of spamming platform manipulation. It was during that time, there were several accounts like mine being deleted under this pretext.
Spam and manipulation. I remember that.
They
were just making it up. Yeah, this is what
they
was
were just
so
making it up.
Wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. They were just making it up, and I didn't even, because I was careful what to post, because I was already banned several times. Get back again. Yeah, so I was careful what to post. So. No idea. I'm not getting back.
Yeah.
I mean, Martin Sellner got back. He had this account MS Life. Everybody knew it was him. Was banned again. I don't know for what reasons. I'm losing account here, because I mean, it gets demoralizing. For example, for you, I mean, it was different for you. It was sort of a miracle, no? You were lifted up again out of oblivion. You had your Twitter audience again.
Yeah. I was really quite surprised. And the weird thing about it was that by the time it happened, I didn't really care. At the time when I got banned, I really, really cared. It meant a lot to me. It meant far too much to me. And I was addicted to the platform. Mm. And so if they'd reinstated me then, it would have been sort of euphoric. But by the time they did reinstate me 4.5 years later, I had long since detached from it all and was quite happy without it. So and then it's there in front of me. I've got my account back, and it was weird. It was so strange how things change. You know, how something that matters to you so much now just doesn't really, and you can take it or leave it. And it might well be the same when, because you probably will. I think you will eventually get that account back one way or another. I just think it will happen, because the direction that Twitter is going is that lifetime bans just aren't. Oh, are you there? Yeah. That Elon Musk clearly just doesn't like the idea of lifetime bans. So I think he'll start asking questions of each government. Like, why are you insisting that we ban this guy? I think that will happen one country at a time. And eventually I think he's just going to say, well, no, I'm not going to ban Martin Selner. He's not an extremist. He's not calling for violence. So fuck you. I think he will. And the same with you as well. I do think eventually you'll get it back. And probably by the time you do, you'll feel like I was, where you just don't really care.
I'm not caring right now. I mean, this is why I had the necessity to create a Telegram channel to get audience again. But I don't remember exactly how many followers I had. It was in 15,000 or so. Well, it was quite a lot, in fact. I mean, now I have.
Yeah, I think it was.
Telegram channel is growing. As a, yeah.
Yeah,
I think it was more than 10,000.
Right, yeah. When I first followed you, you had 6,000. I remember that. I remember that for some reason, clearly. But you know, then you were on for another 2 years or so after I was banned. I can't remember what you had at the end. But yeah, it was a lot. It grew a lot.
I think it was beyond 10,000. But this year, I don't care so much anymore. I mean, it was also a bit exhausting because I got every day this, how you call it?
The social stuff. I know. This is why I'm trying to keep a distance from Twitter this time. Like, I'll go on once a day, do stuff, maybe twice a day.
I was reported every day.
Oh,
I got these
messages.
Right. You have been reported and all, nothing. And I was at this point very careful. So there were these people who were watching me all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And every time they saw something, bah, 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 they make a report. So I get this in my emails every day. And but because they couldn't find anything, they just made this spamming thing up. they couldn't even explain why. It's just so crazy. You're on this machine and you send them a message that I don't know who's going to read it. And you want to ask, can you please specify what exactly I have done? They cannot. At least when you had some naughty tweet, they could say, oh, this is this tweet, delete it or else. But this time they could not. So I was being targeted by people who reported me all the time. And also I got a lot of hate in the comments. I was a bit much more in the open. And it was also a bit exhausting. So I don't miss it so much. It's just useful for advertising stuff that you do. But now
like you do now with the Telegram channel. It's useful for advertising, but the social side of it is more, as you say, back then there was always the threat of people constantly trying to get you banned, and this is what they do it in a very organized way, and they're like insects. It's fucking disgusting, really. But anyway, aside from that, there's also the social side of it, which is, I find exhausting. I mean, on Twitter and on YouTube and on Instagram, there are so many cliques and circles and rumors and all the rest of it, and people bitching at each other. And that kind of stuff is just very tiring. So I try to stay out of all of that kind of thing nowadays. Just don't look at it.
It's a good idea. I used to get into Twitter feuds and arguments a lot years ago. But this was a time when I felt I was much more in the open. I mean, I was much more... you know, my associates were much more in the open. There was really something happening. It felt like you could engage more with the mainstream and with the outside and so. And you could have fights with them. I would have loved to have fights, public discussions. The pussies all avoided it.
Yeah.
They just ran away.
And it can be fun. You know, getting into fights on Twitter can be fun.
Yeah, I mean,
you're dealing with some fucking idiot liberal who doesn't know anything about the subject, which they never do. And yeah,
so just an example. Back in 2007, I'm just always interrupting you. Okay. In 2017, there was this thing at the Frankfurt Book Fair, the presentation of Mai and Sommerfeld's book, Living with Leftists. And there was another book made by these three dudes, which was called Talking with Right-Wing People, Mit Rechten Reden. Yeah, so it was a bit, the titles were very similar. It was quite funny. And Talking with Right-Wing People was a stupid book, to say at least. And there was some lawyer involved, some philosopher, and some writer. And they tried to sort of debunk our strategies of provocation or the way we communicate, right? And the thing is that there was some kind of mutual interest between us and them. We met at the book fair, we talked, and I met these people personally. So we sat down on a table, we talked a bit, and both books were received in the mainstream press as a sort of unit, which had one helped the other sell books. They said, oh, there's this one book and there's the other book. One was writing on the tailcoats of the others. So there was something interesting happening. And of course, the thing that came from our side, because it was suggested in the book, how about having, you know, like the duel at the OK Corral? We have a high noon showdown. We bring our best guns, you bring your best guns, and then we have a public discussion and see what's happening. And it seems like they thought the idea was intriguing at first, but then they got lots of pressure from within their own side. They said, oh, you're too open to them, you're too friendly to them. They got trouble from Antifa, these guys, because they were taking us too serious, being too nice to us. So eventually they just withdraw like cowards, and yes, it became a bit, as usual. Huh? And there was this one guy, the philosopher. So, yeah, he's a philosopher, but he's also a very preposterous narcissist. And I haven't got a philosophical education, but I have a good bullshit detector.
I remember when you told me about this guy and you showed me him, and he seemed like a complete wanker.
He's one of the biggest wanker in this universe. He's a wanker of cosmic proportions. And he's also a malicious person. He's an evil, malicious person. I must say this. And he's impressing people by having this highfalutin language, and he's always very condescending. He tries to make them look stupid. He always blows himself up, making himself look superior. And it just doesn't work on me, because I can see through the bullshit. I have a bullshit detector. I cannot follow into really very detailed philosophical discussions about things, but I know when somebody's bullshitting me, and this guy definitely was. And he got a career. The mainstream press fell for him because, oh, here's this very, very bright guy, and he's debunking populist strategies of deceiving you and arguing. And again, as in many things, it was just the other way around. He was the guy who was deceiving people with words, with twisted arguments, with strategies of confusing you. And I had these Twitter fights with him for hours and hours. And I mean, probably I wasted a lot of my time, my lifetime with it. But at the same time, you sharpen your knives a bit on these kind of people.
I think because the way to do this, yeah, I agree. And I take the point. Yeah. It sharpens your debating claws. But the way to do this is just to hold them to one point and do not let them divert onto some other thing. Ignore every provocation, because they'll put out loads. They'll try to get you away from the point that you want.
This guy constantly did it.
You've got to keep laser focused on that. Mm-hmm. Don't let them change the subject. Don't let them shift the goalposts. Just keep them laser focused. Keep asking the same question until they eventually answer it. And then destroy them for a fucking stupid answer.
Well, this guy was sort of indestructible, because he was so extremely professional in evading and obscuring. It was fascinating. This was like a machine. This guy is like a machine, you know. And I have met others. I mean, not going into that, but you know, I had a discussion with a Zionist on Secession about Israel. So it was like letter exchange and so. And I mean, he's not as bad as the other guy, and I sort of like him, but I felt he was also doing this a lot, twisting the arguments, twisting words. And this becomes very frustrating because you feel you're not having an honest discussion. And this kind of thing should be avoided. Once you realize that people are dishonest and they are just trying to twist words, then you're just wasting your time at one point.
Yes. Eventually, you've just got to conclude this is not going to... They're arguing in bad faith, and it's a waste of my time. Yeah, I agree. There's also just being dismissive from the start. That's another technique. just don't give them the respect that they're accustomed to. Just treat them with contempt. That's another thing that I do a lot nowadays on Twitter. A lot of the time, I'll just reply to something with LOL and just leave it at that. And presumably, yeah, you're expecting that.
Yeah. I hope I've majored in this respect, because I used to be very combative, and it was kind of easy to trigger me. So, because you know, I smell the blood, and then I go in and I take the bait often. So I hope I have learned, you know, not taking the bait too much. Just at one point, just ridicule them. Just fuck them and ridicule it.
Well, look, the society that they've been advocating for is all around us, and it's shit. And that's on them. They have to justify why that girl had to get raped by some fucking refugee. They have to justify why that town is now a shithole. They have to justify why this class, why that white kid no longer belongs at that school. They have should have to justify every single fucking thing that's going wrong because of what they have advocated. And we should be holding them to account, not the other way around. Fuck them.
Yeah, I guess so. Absolutely.
I mean, the results are visible. The results of what they've wanted are visible all around us. It's not a hypothetical thing anymore. So I think they've got a lot
true, but there's this issue that so many people don't really seem to care. And so many people don't seem to see it. They don't feel the same pain as I feel when I see what they do to the Luega monument or building the Moronic fountain or so. So there's a lot of indifference going on. And this is how this just goes on and on and on. And I mean, there was a time when I used to believe.
Sorry, you go.
The norm is important, you know, see? Because the norms go all along with it. I mean, by the way, I had some, maybe this is also an interesting story. I had some post COVID experiences the last few months, which were maybe also telling about normies. So I see in the sub, I have to go with subway and tram a lot. So I see people. And increasingly, the more the cold time of the year approached, I see people increasingly wearing the face masks again. But it's not that many people. So within one car of a tram, there may be two or three of them. But most people don't. And also, I noticed that the people wearing them are very diverse, so to speak. So I see young people, I see old people. Today I saw people had a special contempt for him because he was having a sort of subculture. Yeah, fuck it. Get away, behind me.
Flashback to 2020. Ah!
I got triggered.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so today, for example, I see a guy who was having a sort of subculture gothic kind of look. And he was also wearing a face mask, and I felt such a contempt for him because I thought, you fucker, think you are some special subculture creature. You are just a normie dressed up in a fancy way and you wear this fucking mask. But the thing is, most normies don't wear the masks, you see? Even the old people. So the media did try to create a bit of a fear again. And here's one story I had. You know, whenever I see these people, some side in me comes up and say, I really want to say something nasty to them. I really want to harass them. I want to be nasty to them. But then the good angels of my nature, they say, don't do it. Leave them alone. Don't be like them. Back then, when you were not wearing a mask and they were confronting you, because we are not forced now, it's a free country. If they want, they can do it. But I can't help feeling this contempt for them. I mean, it's okay when there are old people. I mean, it's not really okay because I feel sorry for these old people. So you see them, these scared eyes, you know. But sometimes I see these same scared, stressful eyes in the faces of young people, you know, very young people. What the hell was going on with them? And some of them are maybe signaling some, you know, special responsibility, some special fidelity to what's happening. I'm not quite sure what's going on within each of them. Some may be genuinely scared. So a few days before Christmas, I go into some shop to buy Christmas presents. And everybody in the shop, the people who work there are wearing the masks. And I asked them, why are you wearing those? Are you forced to? And they said, no, we decided that we want to do this. We're not forced to do it. And I hate to look at this. Absolutely hated it. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to buy anything in that shop again. But I had to go there the next day. And the guy behind this counter was this, weakly, disgusting, sexless creature, just a physically disgusting person. And he had the mask in his face. And so I asked him.
How old was he?
Not older than 30, maybe. Was a young guy, yeah. But he was this weakly creature, this I don't know, something shrunken about him. And I get into a sarcastic mode, slightly sarcastic, because I decided I leave these people alone. I leave them alone. But at this point, I got so annoyed because I had to go into the shop and still look at him. And I remembered all the times I went into shops and, you know, they say, yeah, put on a mask. So I ask him, why are you wearing a mask? You know? And he says, I don't want to get sick before Christmas. And I say, oh, that's why you're afraid of getting sick. Yes, he says. And, you know, the numbers are rising. And this is a phrase I used to hear back then. The numbers are exploding. The numbers are rising. The numbers. What kind of numbers? You know, they had the numbers and they were, you know, they were originated by the tests. People were tested all the time. And then when the tests were positive, the numbers were rising of COVID. Yeah? And I really didn't even want to go into that and ask him, you know, how these numbers were generated. Yeah? You know what these numbers said. And even today, I mean, they don't have an idea how much COVID is around now because only some people test themselves now. Many people have COVID and they don't care. They don't know. Because it's just a cold. And so this guy, and so I get sarcastic, says, oh, the numbers are rising. Yeah, I understand. Okay. So like this, I go on like this. And I just couldn't help it. And this guy increasingly, you know, defensive and the scary, mousy eyes. Yes, everybody can do as he likes and blah, blah. And then I said, fine. I find it a bit irritating. And then there's a guy in the line behind me.
Listen,
a guy in the line behind me, and he's not wearing a mask, and he says, well, what's irritating is your opinion. He says to me, and I turn around and I got triggered. I was like a Vietnam veteran triggered by some explosive sound, and then I got the flashbacks again. I was immediately in the hate mode I used to have during that time. And so I said, this is amazing. 2 years later and you are still so brainwashed as you are, you know, and this guy was bitching back. So we were bitching at each other and the guy behind the counter was like, you know.
Oh no.
But when I left the shop, I was so angry because I felt, damn, there are still these people around who haven't learned anything. And I mean, by now you should know that the masks didn't help anything. They were just shit, you know?
The masks didn't help anything. The virus wasn't dangerous.
It's proven.
The PCR test by which you're shown to be infected was bollocks. It was completely unreliable. So every aspect of it was rubbish. They should know this by now.
And they still cling to it. They still believe it. They haven't learned nothing at all. Yeah? And so I think, okay, I see only few people really wearing the mask, which also makes me think of how many people just wore them back then because they were told to, not because they were genuinely afraid. Because I can see even old people, most people are not genuinely afraid now. It's just a few of them, but these few are already enough to annoy me. And then I see a guy who's not wearing a mask, but he would say, listen, everybody can protect himself. And the word protection, I mean, it triggers me. I just can't hear it anymore because every time government wants to protect me from something, oh, thank you. No, I don't want to be protected. Screw you. And he's using this word protection. Says, yeah, okay, protection from what? What are you talking about? I even said this to the guy at the counter. I said, but you know that these masks, they don't do anything. And he admitted and says, yes, they are doing not much, but I want to be careful. And I said, you're so pathetic, pathetic.
Oh, God.
It's like, so pathetic.
Someone just posted this comment.
Fully siding. Mask. I like this word, mask sells.
But yeah, I think there must be a subset of the male population. I mean, women, it's a whole other thing. There must be a subset of the males around the West who've been really infantilized by this. Young men who've been turned into these frightened drones who know, like that guy that you described behind the counter, clearly was embarrassed. He knew that he was being a weak pussy.
I think so. Because he was very defensive and,
yeah,
you know.
So he was ashamed. But he was this thing anyway. Because he's been made into that. Yeah. Fuck.
Oh. He should be shamed and blamed and get his balls back. It's especially, I mean, I find it especially painful when I see young people doing this. And it's a mixture. Sometimes I feel contempt. I reactively, when I see the guys, I feel contempt. When I see girls, and sometimes pretty, I suppose they're pretty girls behind the mask, young girls, I feel sorry for them. Because they are so stupid, and I excuse women a bit more. Sorry to say this, because it's women are by nature more common.
Yeah,
but it's also very, it shows my love for women. I just know their nature, and I love them as they are. So, but they are more conformist than men. But men who do it, they're just contemptuous for me. So, yeah. So I see these ghosts. There were some ghosts of COVID past haunting here and then, you know, now in the last weeks before Christmas. But there was just this one incident where I did a deliberate provocation. It was the only time I did it. But I just couldn't help it. I was so annoyed by that guy. And so I was a bit going a bit sarcastic, but it was like a test. It was like some test, and I thought, there's still some shit there. It's not gone, and people haven't understood, which is depressing. But on the other hand, I see it doesn't take off that much.
Ironically, what would probably make that guy behind the counter stop wearing the mask is if a woman mocked him for it. Yeah, like a young woman. Huh? If she said something like, sorry, I want a real man. not a mask cell, then that would probably bring them into, you know, you'd think, oh, I'm not going to get any sex if I keep doing this. I'm going to stop ruining my own chances.
Well, okay. If there are women listening now to the stream, this is your mission, ladies. Go and shame these guys to get their balls back. Please do it for me and do it for mankind. And so maybe it works on some. Maybe you can save some
to get their balls back. Oh, it would work. Yeah. I'm sure it would work on young
definitely,
guys. If they think that this is actually ruining my chances with women, they would stop it.
I should have asked that guy, you want to be an incel, or are you already, or what's going on? No, I can't be that. The thing is, in my mind, I can be very nasty, have lots of nasty fantasies what to do with people who annoy me, but in real life, I'm nice. I'm really nice. I'm polite. I feel bad about being unkind to people, so I never am. But you see, so I admit I'm mentally capable, but not in real life.
Someone's just mentioned the clapping for the NHS, and this was a thing. I expect that there were equivalents of it in Austria. There was a thing where somebody, there it is, someone had this photo that they found online of someone doing it, like banging pots and pans for the NHS. And it looked like me.
It looked like you were banging.
Yeah, it looked like me. Hold on a second, I'll put it up because it's funny. That's just it. And I want to emphasize this isn't me, right? But
Don't lie. I can see it's you. It's you, all right.
Me,
you were in it in the beginning. Go admit it.
No, honestly, it's just someone who looks like me.
You look much prettier. It's not you. And, I'd do anything to protect our NHS and save grandparents.
That's my sarcastic caption that I wrote.
It's your caption.
But no, it's not me. But it was a thing. It was like a ritual, and this was part of what added to this. I mean, we've talked about this before. We don't need to go into it here, but I'll say it one last time that it was like a religious thing where this is how to prove that you're good. This is how to you make your sacrifice and you don't commit the sin and you listen to the priest, you obey what the scientists say, and here's a ritual to you undergo in order to affirm your faith. It's all very sick. But, as other people will see, it is 3 years ago. So thank God for that.
I mean, I think some of the people who are wearing these masks today are still within, they're loyal to that cult. They still cling like religious people, like cultists. They still wear them to show how good and caring people they are. Even now, especially now, maybe. Now that nobody's wearing it, it maybe gives them a feeling of being true nonconformists and so. So sometimes I thought about it. Is this now a reverse situation? I mean, back then it isn't. I mean, of course I realized that because back then it took courage not to wear a mask. It doesn't courage to wear it now because it's still approved. People are used to it. There are just some guys like me who are annoyed or maybe people who don't say it, but it's not socially discredited to do it. It's still okay. Right, because there hasn't been a real change or revision of what happened. Also, I mean, our politicians, they have learned nothing. They pretend they are doing a sort of revaluation, but it's all very, very phony. And of course, they all want to get away with it, what they have done. And this is also another thing which makes me very sour on them, and on dear Karl Nehammer, whom I mentioned before. So I don't think we will ever see that really get revised.
There's an inquiry going on just now in Britain about COVID, but I expect it to be just a whitewash, just a waste of time.
Same here. Same here. They also had a government inquiry, but it's just completely, doesn't have any substance. It's just a whitewash, just an alibi. And that's all. But society will continue to be split because there are now people who very different ideas of what happened. They live in very different worlds, and I don't think this can be reversed either. So whenever you get to meet new people or you interact with normies, you have to find out in which universe are they living, which movie, which timeline are they in. And people are living. It's also another way to separate people more and more, and to isolate them.
One other aspect of this is, as you alluded to this, where it's a guy in sort of subcultural clothing. He looks like he obviously sees himself as a bit of a rebel. But all of his bands the bands that he listens to will have been saying, wear the mask, and COVID is real and all that. This is an interesting thing because, and I think you'll have a lot to say about this. I remember around about this, sometime in the late 2000s, I saw some middle-aged women celebrating, talking about the band The Killers, and they were singing the songs and dancing along and all this. And I thought, rock music is supposed to be for rebellious young people. And that was weird. It was strange to see middle-aged, like normie, mainstream women taking part in rock culture, rock music. And then 10 years later, COVID happened, and you had the bands like the Kaiser Chiefs shilling for Pfizer, the vaccine.
Rage Against the Machine.
Exactly.
Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
Yeah.
They were shilling as well for vaccines, these fuckers.
Yes.
These little preposterous fuckers.
Yes. And it's an interesting thing because it's like the entire purpose of rock music has been turned upside down, where it's now... The question is, how far back does this go? Was it always just the establishment conditioning the public? But certainly nowadays, rock culture, emo, punk, grunge, whatever subset of it you look at, they were all pro-COVID, pro-mask, pro-vaccine. And it goes the same with climate change, the same with LGBT, the rainbow, mass immigration, multiculturalism. They're all in agreement on everything. So none of these bands, none of these genres of music are actually rebelling at all against anything that the establishment does. And I find this fascinating because I think to be a Zoomer must be very different from being a Millennial or Gen X, or certainly Boomer, because the mainstream is now in... It is the same thing as the subculture in every way that matters. So then the subculture is literally nothing more than a style of clothing and a style of music, but it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any rebelliousness in it at all anymore. It's just an aesthetic. What would you say about that?
I could say a lot about that. By the way, it was Ted Kaczynski who mentioned this once in one of his writings. I don't know if it was in the manifesto or somewhere else. He said that the system doesn't care what clothes you wear, what music you listen to. The only thing is you have to conform and go along. And it can even create the illusion of a sort of diversity or pluralism. By having look, there are these different music styles, but in the end, if you go beyond the surface, they all align in the same thing. So again, this is another fake diversity. I mean, diversity has always been, this is, by say, Morrissey is one of those who's different. And I'm glad about that because I like Morrissey a lot. And he would say that diversity is a, what did he say? Is another word for conformism or for, he nailed it, you know, because it's one of those upside down things where a concept you heard mentioned means exactly the opposite of what it pretends to be. And yeah, I'm not sure of how much fake it was. It depends on the people. My idea, I think, you know, recently I reviewed a book by a film director I used to like many years ago. He was this German underground horror movie director, Jörg Butgereit. Have you heard about him? He's from Berlin.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, okay. So he... okay, here's a funny story that the first Martin Lichtness article ever published in a sort of gothic, neo-folk, industrial music fanzine was in 2000 and was an interview with Jörg Butgereit. I sort of ambushed him. He was working in a cinema theater as a projectionist, but he had created in the 1980s these very interesting, very crass underground horror movies, which were made on a complete low budget. One of them was called Necromantic, and it's a crass film about necrophilia, and he would push the limits like crazy. But it was all done with a bunch of freaks who were his friends, was shot on 8mm film, on 16mm film, and it was done completely out of non-commercial passion. And these films have a great intensity to them. I mean, they're not masterpieces or anything, but back then when I was a film student in the early 2000s, they mattered to me because I liked the passion and intensity of them. And so I ambushed Butgereit after a screening of a film, and I jump at him and say, "Oh, listen, I want to make an interview with you for a fanzine." He agreed, yes. So he's a very nice, really a nice, sympathetic guy. And we met and sat down, and I had an old school tape recorder with a tape where you push rec play, and I have this tape still. And then I transcribed it, translated it into English, and I wrote also an article about the art of Jörg Butgereit and the way, you know, I thought it was interesting the way he talked, he about death, you know. This was something that was much on my mind. There's also, I digress here a bit, but maybe it's interesting for you and your listeners, and it goes very well to what you said about the rebellion thing. There was one film that also meant quite a lot to me, which called Der Todesking, which meant the King of Death, and was a film made of episodes, and in each episode there's a suicide. And some episodes are more parodistic, some are ridiculous, intentionally so, some are really crass. And there was something to this film which I felt was very strong. So, and these people who made these films, they were not intellectuals at all. In fact, they were people who despised art house movies. But I felt they had a grasp on something. So I made this interview with Jörg Butgereit, and it was a very interesting experience. And this was the first Lichtness article ever published. And now Butgereit has published memoirs, a book of memoirs, which I reviewed. And he was a child of West Berlin. He grew up as a kid in the 70s, mostly 60s, 70s. He was addicted to pop culture. He would watch movies on TV and especially the trash movies. He would love monster movies, Bruce Lee movies, Godzilla, all this kind of stuff. And he would go into deep into pop culture. And you see, if you are interested in a certain kind of music or culture, the West Berlin of this area has a special fascination because it was a brooding house of subcultures. It was isolated, an isolated piece of the West within the DDR or GDR. And in that, lots of interesting things happened. And, you know, the myth about David Bowie living there with Iggy Pop and Nick Cave later on and Einstürzende Neubauten, all these kinds of people I found fascinating and loved the music. And they were there. I mean, you get the mood of West Berlin, of these areas, when you listen to the Bowie records recorded at that time, you know, from Station to Station and all that kind of things. Yeah. So Butgereit, he grew up in this area, and the memoir is like a diary of what he watched and what he saw, what people he met, what concerts he went to. And what I found so fascinating is there was a strange anything goes mentality. There were no bounds, there were no limits, yeah, to explore things. And also, what you might also find interesting is it was the pre-digital age. When you wanted to get hold on a film, you needed to have either see it on TV, catch it on TV. You needed to see it on a screen. You could get Super 8 copies of it, which were heavily mutilated. It was hilarious. I mean, they had films, horror films, they were cut down to 30 minutes and you had all the horror scenes in it and the rest was cut. Yeah? When you wanted to listen to certain records, you needed to get the record, you needed somebody to copy a tape for you. And so, and this was the time when, for example, bands like Throbbing Gristle or Psychic TV were active. All these kinds of people I found very interesting. At that time, what they were doing was really shocking, was really disturbing for people. It was limited to small audiences. And I found it fascinating to dive with the Butgereit diaries into this scene, into this area. And I for my part, I always feel, I wish I had been there. I was born too late. I only caught a whiff of it when I lived in Berlin. The first time I visited Berlin was in 1995. And it was still reconstructed. There were parts of Berlin which were ruins, and they built up the new Potsdamer Platz. And I had in mind a film I still like very much. It's called, the English title was Wings of Desire, but the original title is Der Himmel über Berlin, which means the sky or heaven above Berlin. And it was shot 2 years before the wall came down in black and white. In the divided city, and you have these two angels, and they look like casual guys in trench coats, and one of them is Bruno Ganz, the famous German actor. You know, he played Hitler in The Downfall. Everybody has seen the famous...
Yes, and I know him from Herzog's Nosferatu. I still haven't seen Downfall, actually.
Yeah, of course. Of course he was in Nosferatu. He was a wonderful actor. And in this film, they wander through Berlin at that time in black and white. And you see, they're invisible to human beings, and they can hear their inner monologues. They can hear them talking. And there's some scenes when there's a man who wants to jump off a building. He wants to die. And the angel approaches him, and the angel puts his hand on his shoulder and tries to stop him. But the man decides to jump, and the angel cries out in pain. And at one point, the angel hopes to become a human being. He longs to be a human being. And the wish gets granted miraculously. So he falls like down to earth. And then he goes into a shop and he buys some silly clothes and he tastes coffee and cigarettes. And what's so fun is the first thing he does is to celebrate life. He goes into a Nick Cave concert. A Nick Cave concert. And it's a dark club full of goth and punk people. And there's Nick Cave of that area looking like a heroin junkie, Blixer Bagel in the band. And they're playing a very dark song, From Her to Eternity. And you see Nick Cave, and the angel is next to him, the other angel who is still an angel. And he hears Nick Cave's inner monologue and says, whatever, I'm not going to tell them about the girl. And then he starts up, I'm going to tell you about a girl. You know, she lives in room 29. And then it goes this very crazy psychopathic song. And I thought it was crazy that the angel becomes a human being to celebrate life. The first thing he does, he goes listen to this song. So anyway, well, I'm digressing, but I want to paint a picture here a bit, you see. So there's this mythical idea I had of Berlin of that time and of what experienced, and I could see what it would be like to live there, like Jörg Butgereit. And I understand also this obsession with pop culture, this obsession with obtaining the cool records on vinyl, on cassettes, of seeing the movies you cannot see today. Almost everything is available. The internet has become a huge treasure house where you can download anything. You can download tons of music, never listen to it, downloads all the movies, never listen to it. But there was a time when obtaining these things was much more difficult and much more valuable. And I do miss these times. So I'm old enough that I had a whiff of the pre-digital era, and it has sort of gone. But while reading this, I realized, for example, Butgereit, he was a friend of this guy, Bela B. Felsenheimer, who was member of a punk band called Die Ärzte, which means the doctors or the medics, right? And back in the 80s, they were a very naughty band with politically incorrect lyrics and very, you know, they like to push the envelope with obscene lyrics, but they were mostly tongue-in-cheek. And I remember when I was a child, it was very naughty to listen to them. Huh? When you got a record of the Ärzte, it was when I was 12 years old. And today, they are still around. And of course, they are the most conformist band you can think of. They are just contemptible. You know, they go along with every mainstream thing. These are guys in their 60s now. They have never grown up. They always stayed this juvenile, immature, leftist people. They haven't changed, and they are part of the establishment completely. Yeah. So it's a big downy, big turn off. Yeah. And this was a friend of Butgereit. And Butgereit, I mean, I still like him. He's an okay guy. He's not political at all. He is also like a big child, but he's also a very, I had the impression also when I talked to him, a very grounded person. You know, he has made these very sick movies, but he seems like a sane person to me. Yeah. And I still like him. And as I said, he's not political at all, but some of his friends from older times are. So by reading through this book, I had these mixed feelings, because I thought many of these things that were taboo, transgression, they seem so lame today. They seem so irrelevant today. I understand there was a time when you could say, wow, John Waters movies are radical and cool. Yeah. And I understand the appeal of it. So I was never into John Waters. I mean, I was into other stuff. I liked more, where we talk about crazy gay stuff, it would be more like Kenneth Anger movies, which I still adore. They're absolutely fascinating things. But they also lost their power of provocation. They also lost their transgressive character. And this is one thing that after you have this break, you reach a point, there's a sort of rush you get, but it does lead to nowhere. It doesn't change, make the world a better place. It doesn't really make a revolution that makes things better. I mean, what happened in the end, we have this really dreadful, you know, LGBTQ queer stuff today. And this makes you think, I mean, was it bad in the first place? When did it turn bad? And this is also a question for me as a guy who was into goth music. And I could see, yeah, they were also gender bending a lot. And most of them were not political. But in the end, you know, they were mostly leftists, as everybody was at that time. Susie and the Banshees, I mean, they were wearing these swastikas, ironically, in the beginning. Yeah, or Sid Vicious, you know, the thing, because they just gave a fuck. They wanted to provoke and they withdraw a bit, all this kind of stuff. So what's left of it, you know, is the art they have created. Some of them have created real beauty, beautiful music, which you can listen to no matter what your political affiliations are. I don't see any problem by that, because it's beautiful art. It's great. It's thing. But the political thing, the rebellious thing about it, I don't know how it can be transformed. I don't know how it can be sort of updated, because I still believe in it of sorts.
Yeah, you and I are old enough that we lived through this in our youth, and it was, even though it was, I think, largely illusory, it was exciting, and transgression is exciting. Mm. But the thing is that the young today don't seem to feel that at all. That's what's so interesting, that they don't even want. I think this would be meaningless to a lot of young people today. What they expect from rock culture and subculture is not this. They don't expect it to tell them anything different from the mainstream, and it doesn't. So there.
They don't even want fake rebellion. Yeah, they don't even want fake rebellion.
If the goth band were to tell them something that Pepsi Cola or Microsoft weren't telling them, I think that would be shocking. That would be bizarre to them.
I mean, as I can see, I'm not so updated. Sometimes I look, there's still some goth bands around who can make music like it used to be. Some of them pretty good. I don't see much political thing about it. But you see, the non-political thing also fits into the system. You just consume your type of music, no matter what it is. You can listen to Bach or punk rock or bad German rap music. And it doesn't matter to the system. You have just your taste of consumption. And on a level, I'm fine with that, because I think people need these kind of things. At least I do. You know, I want to have music in my life. I want to have beauty in my life. I want to have things in my life which are not political, right? But it all operates within a larger network. And this myth of youth rebellion, it was in many ways largely a myth, but what people made of it was not, because the way you lived it, what your attitude were, what happened out of it. But in the end, it was all kept under control of an overall system. The thing is, I'm stuttering here a bit because I realized there would be so many things to say about that. So But what I'm pointing is, I think very similar as what you say, that the kids even lost the taste for rebellion, even the taste for not even fake rebellion they want. And
that begs the question: was it artificial? Was it inculcated in us, our generations, and actually teenagers don't naturally have this rebellious streak?
Don't get me there. It's depressing to think of it. Because I want to think that the youth should rebel, youth should want to make things different. And goes, listen, I don't think it's fake, because these kind of things go way back in the 20th century, even before there was pop culture. One thing I was, for example, always fascinated by was the early German youth movements, which started in the early 1900s, took over into the 20s. In the 30s, much of it was...
I've forgotten the name.
Wandervogel. Yes. Wandervogel was one of those groups. There were many different... Wandervogel was one of the most important groups. And I used to read and study a lot about that. And... this was a sort of genuine cultural rebellion back then. Like the youth at this, they were mostly in these high schools. It started in Berlin, actually, Berlin Steglitz. And they would get permissions from the teacher that they could have trips without the teachers. First, there was some teachers who took them to trips into forests. And then gradually some older kids took over and they had permission to take these trips. And then it would become more and more wild. They would dress up in a way that they wanted to look medieval. They wanted to look ancient. It was a romantic thing. They discovered the acoustic guitar, which was an instrument very much neglected, but they could see it was easy to take with you on a trip into a forest, and you could play folk songs on it, and you could write songs in it. They were easy to take if you make a fire on a camp. And this thing, as far as I can see, was a genuine impulse within society, because there was a need for renovation. There were lots of things that were not working out in this Kaiser Wilhelm Society, and the youth felt it was too bourgeois, it was too limiting, and it was also one of the reasons why many young people had this excitement about the World War, even without the propaganda. Famously, you know, Ernst Jünger, the writer, he was, when the war started, he was 19 or 20, and he in the book Storm of Steel, he would say, this was finally something liberating. They felt stifled, they felt bored, and the war seemed to be like a big romantic adventure of blood and roses, and eventually it turned into this nightmare of the trenches war, which was an extreme experience, absolutely extreme experience, which was destroyed everything that had been there before. And when they came back from the trenches, the youth movement had also changed. It became more political, it became more radical. Some were extreme left, some were far right groups, all wanted to change society. So there was a genuine thing going on and a genuine need. Yeah. And this was before there was pop culture that gave you, let's say, rock and roll records you can listen to and buy in masses and all that. I mean, the culture that was targeted at young people, teenagers as consumers, this was happened, I think it started really in the 1950s or so, especially in America, that you had a new class of consumers. Yeah.
Just the whole thing about the teenager was invented in the 1950s.
I mean, I think the teenager was invented way before, but the way it was commercialized was a 1950s thing, I'd say. Yeah. And I would rather say that this need of young people to change something, to be rebellious, and there were things that needed to be changed. I think in 1970s Britain, there were a lot of reasons to be really angry about, to create this angry punk music, to be against life in there, which seemed meaningless, ugly, and all that. And I think it was also exploited in a way. So I think there were genuine impulses, but they were exploited, they were commercialized. I think it's a very complex story because everybody knows how the Sex Pistols were, designed by Malcolm McLaren and so. But the impulses they created, the countless bands, the impulse for creativity was set free. So everybody said, okay, if I can I can play a punk song as well, everybody can, right? This, I think, was a genuine energy that was there. And I think this has disappeared much more with the digital age and also with the downfall of youth cultures. Because back then, before there was the internet, there was also the need to meet up, to gang up, to form a tribe, to dress up in a way, at least the way I experienced it in the 90s when I was with the Gothic people. I talked about it in some interview, the way we would have to meet up in real life to create our own world, to be really different by doing something else. And for me, this was a absolutely genuine thing. And then it got swallowed up by, even back then there were talks about what is the real music? What is the commercial shit? You know, this is what nerds like to do.
Who's sold out? Yeah.
Who's fake? It also happens in other scenes, especially the black metal scene, the metal scene, which was kind of related to our scene by affiliation or by tastes and so. So I think possibly it seems it has disappeared, this wish for rebellion. I think it's a natural wish. Maybe people are really pleased now, maybe young people are happy now. This is fine, this is the life we want. We look at our smartphones,
the thing is, there is a form of rebellion that's encouraged in kids nowadays, and it's to further subvert society, in the way that it's been going for decades, to have more, like, because your school might have an LGBT day, but it's secretly homophobic. Your school is homophobic. Mm. So you, as a young person, well, you can really piss off the adults by being even more gay-friendly. This kind of thing. And, of course, climate change as well. to the extent that anyone takes it seriously, it's, you know, 15-year-old girls, I guess.
Well, by now it's hard to catch up with the radicalism of above, you know. It's hard to be even more radical than what's already going on from above. I mean, one example, I had a kind of a shock this year when I got back to the place where I went to high school. It's a cozy little town in Lower Austria, very bourgeois. And there was this high school. I went there just to see how it looks today. I went there for different reasons, but I was there and said, let's take a look at my old school, because this old school is still inside me. I have been there for 8 years, and I sometimes even dream of being there again. I remember the building very well. And in my dreams, I'm still there going up, downstairs. And so, and I went there, and the first thing I see was in June. The first thing I see was a gigantic rainbow flag in front of the school.
Holy fuck. You know,
a gigantic one.
I so identify with your nostalgia, your attachment to this place, mm-hmm. this building. And I so understand what you're saying here, that it's like an empire has taken it over and has stamped its brand on the fucking building. So it's and you know, you read my essay that I didn't actually publish because it became too big, called The Rainbow Regime. And it's one of the essays that I'm going to do next year. I'm going to finish it next year. And that's interesting as well. There's a whole thing that we could talk about there. But this was like 6 months ago when I wrote that. It seemed like a triumphant regime, a new thing that had just taken basically everything. But every pop band, every rock band, every museum, every government, every academic department, you couldn't escape it. And so even when you go back to somewhere that was sacred to, that is sacred to you, some from your past, it has been, it's almost like it's retrospective, gone back into the past to seize this thing. It's taken everything. So yeah, I know.
Yeah, I can really, if you want to, I'll go into that a bit and describe what my school used to be when I was there in the 1990s. I mean, I have rather good memories. You got a good education. It was already deteriorating back then by progressive ideas, I must say. They lowered the standards. So I can see the virus was already in there. But I remember that what I saw in June this year was crassly ideological. And I will describe a bit how. But first, back then, how it was, I mean, it went along with the mainstream. But I remember, for example, one thing. We had these different kinds of teachers. And teachers are people, I don't know what's it like with you, but you remember them all your life. They are personalities. People who take this profession are often, they have a character. And every teacher had a different character and had different influence on you. And I'm grateful for many of the teachers I had. And we had teachers all over the spectrum. I had a German literature teacher. She was this very conservative, dignified woman. And we always made a bit fun out of her, of being a monarchist and being nostalgic about the old days and so. And I must say, I learned from her a lot. You know, I really loved her. She also loved me because I was into literature as well, very much. And she was just a very important figure for me, dearly remembered. Then I had a teacher in history, and I remember him dearly as well. And he was a Green Party guy. He was a leftist, more hippie, not so much to say. But I must say he had the heart on the right spot. For example, he used to play in a folk band, which would play traditional music from all over Europe, but also from Austria. And so he was a sort of ethno-pluralist, without really knowing it. He thought he was a multiculturalist, but I won't go into that. There's a difference between being a multiculturalist and a pluralist. And I didn't like his history teaching because it was not very effective. I had a more conservative history teacher, which I liked more, but I liked him as a personality. He taught me a lot, and he also had an appreciation for me, and he would be heartbroken probably if he still cares about me. I don't know. He had so many pupils, but if he knew what happened to me, he would, he wouldn't understand the world because I was one of his favorite pupils. So we had left-wing teachers, we had right-wing teachers. They were all over the spectrum, and they all were part of the school system. So you have the feeling that all these positions are legit, and you can make up your own minds. You're not being forced into one thing. And now, switch back, almost 30 years later, I go back to the school. I see the rainbow flag, and not only that, I see these silly slogans everywhere, painted in rainbow colors like kindergarten kids. I mean, these are people in their teens, and like love is love and stuff like that. You have all these stupid diversity slogans all over the building. And then I see the English class. They had made posters where they discuss a third rate civil rights political figures from the US. You have never heard, even I have never heard of them, like some black lesbian and some whatever, people who are completely unimportant. They are just there for the ideology. They do not learn about the important people. And by God, they can discuss Martin Luther King, because whatever you think of him, he's an important figure. But they had this third-rate people discussed, and it was complete brainwashing. It wasn't just brainwashing, it was infantilizing. No? It was an absolute shocking downgrade of the level I was used to. And I left this building with my heart was, And then I did a thing, and I have to mention this. I had a teacher back then, another teacher in a special German class, and I was very fond of him. I learned of him a lot. And he was also an old school leftist, who had his youth in the 60s, 70s, you could tell, but he knew his business about literature. And he taught me a lot, and he was also a very kind man. And there was some special work I wrote about an Austrian writer under his guidance. And it even earned me a prize back then. I got a prize for it from the city. They had some youth talent prize, and it was so good that I had a prize, and he helped push it. He said, give this young man some. I got a bit of money of it, and I was mentioned in a local newspaper with a photo. So I had grateful memories, but he realized I was going into a direction he didn't like. So one day, I was already done from school. I was studying at university. I'm in a train, and I'm dressed all in black, and I read Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche. And I see him in the train. He sees me and he says, why are you reading Nietzsche? He says, too much Nietzsche is not good. It's not good, right? He says, okay. I think I have to read more Nietzsche. So he said, he realized I was getting into a direction he didn't really like. And so years later, I wanted to find out if he's still alive. And I wasn't sure. I found his email somewhere on the net, but I didn't have information. I mean, he's in his 70s now. Has he died? Is he sick? Is he just tired? I found out that he's still alive, but he's retired. And I wrote him an email under this address, and I said, maybe you can remember me. And I just wanted to talk to him and say, what do you think about what happened to our school? Because I know many of these old school leftists who have conservative instincts, they don't feel well about how far it is going. They feel bad about it. And I wanted to know what his opinion would be, but I didn't get an answer. Maybe the email was wrong. Maybe he Googled me and thought, no, or he was just tired. I have no idea, but I would have liked to know what his opinion would have been.
Yeah, I understand. On the one hand, it shouldn't matter what he thinks, because he's just one more person in your life, and you don't need to know his opinion. But
No, I need, listen, stop, let me stop here. I want to know his opinion because I would like to know what's happening in people like him.
Yes,
Yeah?
yes, yes.
Yeah? I
How
want to
much
know
has he
about
changed?
people. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know. It's like, how much have they kept up with the changing
Yeah.
politics of the time? Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we had this talk about people like John Cleese, these old school leftists, who are sort of overrun by the woke thing and who look conservative now in comparison and who are not comfortable with what's happening. Yeah. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon. And I just was curious, you know, I didn't want to convince if he would talk have talked to me, I would just wanted to ask his opinion because I was curious if there
I've
had been
got
any change. Yeah. Yeah.
I've got a similar thing with several of my teachers that I would really like to talk to them now. Just well, I wouldn't necessarily enjoy it, but it would be interesting to talk to them now. I mean, the
Yeah.
thing is, they're old. You know, I realized, and this really saddened me. I realized that all of my teachers were on the verge of retirement, so. A lot of them just like within 5 years of me leaving high school, the staff was completely different. Certainly within 10 years, hardly barely any of them were still there. So they were actually quite old for their time. And but I would. There are two of them that I would like to get in touch with. One of them, my English woman who taught me English, we taught us Shakespeare and stuff, and she did not like me. And I did not like her.
Yeah.
And I'd like to talk to her now just to thank her, to say, look, I know I was a little shit. I know, and I'm sorry. I was rebellious. You knew it. You could tell, and you could tell that I didn't like you. I know, and I'm just sorry. And thank you for being such a good teacher that I still now, what, 20 years later, 25 years later, still value what you taught me. I'd like to, because I think the thing is, an ordinary person would really appreciate being told that. But she was so sour that I think she wouldn't appreciate it. I think she would just say, right, goodbye. Thank you for saying that. Bye-bye. I can imagine it would go like that. Because she really was very snooty and that was why we didn't get along. But the thing is, she was a fucking good teacher. She really was very good. She taught us Romeo and Juliet, which is kind of weird because she was so serious and sort of straight-laced. But she taught us that, and I think the other one that she taught us was it wasn't Macbeth. Oh, The Merchant of Venice, actually. Oddly enough. So I'd like to contact her just to say thank you and to apologize for being the way I was back then. But the other one is my religious studies teacher. And it would be a much more strange interaction with him because I'd like to say to him, why did you mislead me so much? And you must have
Right.
known that you were misleading me.
In
Like,
which way do you
well,
think he misled you?
he taught me to basically despise my society. And he encouraged those instincts. There's a revolutionary instinct. He probably thought that I was going to become some sort of hardcore leftist, and I did for a while, you know, in my late teens. But I think he'd be f shocked. The way I've turned out. I don't know whether he was Jewish, but I've got a feeling that he was, because he had a connection with Israel. He used to take he would take kids to Israel every year, and that's how I went to Israel when I was 16. But I don't know if he was. I just, and yeah, I don't actually think he was. I think he was just very much of that 60s, 70s new left sort of mentality. And probably a philo Semite, but he did have all of this sort of thinking packed in there about And he wasn't a Marxist. I remember him once saying that Marx had a faulty model of man. He was working with a faulty model of man. I remember him saying that. So he wasn't a Marxist as such, but he was a sort of, I don't know, anarchist, revolutionary, like a lefty revolutionary, I think.
New left, so also.
Yeah.
Critical of Marxism, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd like to say to him, because he did encourage me so much at the time, and he gave me a very high opinion of myself, which I might have had anyway, yeah. But he definitely made it worse. And I'd like to say to him, what, don't you care about society? Don't you value stability and tradition? And don't you think that the young should be taught to do the same? Because I really wonder what he would say. And I don't think he's a bad guy. I mean, just in case this somehow gets back to him, I don't think he's a bad guy. I think he's...
Yeah.
And I think he's kind of, well, I think he's mistaken. Obviously I do. That's why I've turned against everything that he taught me. So, yeah, but it's a weird thing, isn't it, to still have this relationship in your head with someone from your past who probably doesn't think about you very often, if at all. I mean, he's probably forgotten all about me.
Well, I guess the same for me and many of my teachers, because they had hundreds of students during decades. So you tend to think of yourself more important because they were so important for you. But they had so many of them. Maybe they just faintly remember you. And if you wanted to start a discussion about him, why he misled you, you would also have to explain to him, what do you mean by that? Because he wouldn't understand it. You would first have to say where the misleading started or what the misleading is about. And probably he wouldn't even understand. I mean, it would have been an interesting experiment.
Certainly would. Certainly would be interesting. Even to record it and publish it would be interesting. Because Yeah, but I don't think he would do it. I mean, I don't even know if he's still alive. That's the thing. I've got a similar problem that you've got and the thing is, he almost certainly will have heard that because of the ferocity of the way I was doxxed, he will have heard about that. Everyone in the town, because he actually did live in the hometown, everyone knew. So
you think it's likely he heard about it?
It's likely? Yeah. I'd be amazed if he hadn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So he will know that much. And he's probably thinking, what the fuck happened there? You know. And I don't really know what to tell him, except that I thought I was pro-equality when I was 15, but I grew out of it. Why haven't you? Why didn't you grow out of it?
He should have been grown out when he was your teacher by then, but we'll stick all his life.
I think a lot of people did and still do.
I mean, my teacher, I told you about this German class, special German class teacher. He was about quality a lot. I mean, he was discerning about literature texts. And I remember one funny thing it's mid-1990s, and we were this small group of having this special extra German class with him, and we were six people or so, not more. The majority of it were girls. I think we were two guys and the rest were girls. And he had this idea that we discuss literature of women from the 1970s and 60s. I mean, this is the time when he got his youth and he got his political enlightenment. And it was sort of feminist or proto-feminist literature. And the funny thing is that everybody hated it, even the girls. The girls thought it was boring and it didn't speak to them at all. And he was sort of not connecting with us. He could see we were of a different era, and these were not issues that concerned us. And also the the examples that we read, I mean, we talked about them critically. He didn't put it on there that we just revere it and say it's good, but we would talk about it critically, what it says, do we like it or not, and what kind of style is it. So I learned about it as well. And there was also one writer who was an exception, and this is the one I wrote about, was Marlene Haushofer. She wasn't a feminist, I couldn't say. Some people claim she would be in some ways, but she was just a good writer, a good, interesting writer. And the basic theme of her books is the theme of isolation, loneliness. I could relate to that because I was a very, very alienated teenager. But the takeaway from me is here that his leftist kind of ideas, they wouldn't get through to us very much, even to the others. It was mid-1990s. Huh? So this is also one of the reasons why I wonder what he would say now. Also about, I mean, the methods used in that school now are so infantilizing, so brainwashing. This would completely against the quality standards he had. Yeah? And this is why I would have been so curious to hear whether he's even aware of it. But he's even aware of it. Yeah. But I guess I will never know.
It's a shame. I mean, there you could try harder. You could try other ways. Like, I'm sure there are things you could do to try to get in touch with them. And you probably should. I mean,
My brother had been in class with his son, one of his sons. And they occasionally meet, have a class meeting. So I asked my brother that if you meet his son, just ask him, I would like to get in contact. Maybe he will react then. I don't know.
Yeah.
And his son was a funny guy. I liked him. He was into punk rock, and I introduced him to goth music. So he had a sort of friendship, not very deep one. We just knew each other.
Wait there a second. I want to get a drink, but I'm still listening to you. So just
okay. So you're still yeah. Wait.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Just 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. Hold on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Da da da. What I'm going to do now and tomorrow, all our yesterdays have lighted through. No. Creeps in this petty pace from day to the last. I was entertaining the audience with a bit of Shakespearean mumbling. By the way, did you know that William Shakespeare was in fact Edward the Bear?
Oh no! Oh no! The fear posting! The fear posting has begun! You're using millennial for your propaganda.
Yes, I wanted to slip it into it, and now I'm there. I have my foot in the door. So we talk for 2 more hours, and no, I'm just kidding. Well, just want to put it out there. Google Oxfordian theory. You see, yeah. And you will see how Stratfordians are the scum of the earth. They make everything bad. So
Litmus has just outed himself as an Oxfordian. Yeah, he does not subscribe to the Stratfordian. Mm. Thesis that Shakespeare was who he's supposed to be, but rather he believes that Shakespeare was Edward de Vere, or the plays were written by Edward de Vere. So it's a whole thing. It's a whole thing, and Litmus is really into it.
Yes, I am.
Thank you. So it's something that people can look into.
For me, it's also the greatest conspiracy theory around, my favorite conspiracy theory. And once you dive into this rabbit hole, it's one of the most fascinating things you can get into, provide you like Shakespeare. Oh, and talking about Shakespeare, there's another thing I wanted to address. You mentioned this teacher who taught you about Shakespeare. And I think in your Substack, you mentioned a story, how you met up with your brother and his wife. And you talked about...
Oh, no, no, that was a different... What? I haven't. But first of all, I haven't published that yet. So that's for next.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and second...
But I read it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I read it, I wrote it. But there were quite a few that I wrote and didn't, but I felt that they needed more work. So, and that was one of them. And the second, it wasn't my brother and his wife. It was a different they were connected to the family, but
confused that.
Just to be clear, but it was not that was a whole thing. That was a nasty experience that I had around about 2012, before I started the channel. And I think I've talked about it here and there. I've mentioned it, but basically what happened was I said that, I must have made myself so unpopular at this.
Good. I'm proud of you, even back then.
It was me.
You were not afraid to make yourself unpopular in this situation?
Yeah, I think I was sort of spurgy enough to just go ahead and do it and just say the thing, you know. Just annoy everyone else at the table by saying this thing. And I went ahead and did it twice during on different topics during this one meal. Yeah. We were at a restaurant. It was me and some relatives and their partners. And the topic of the royal family came up. And I think this was just when William and Kate were getting or had just got married. And this woman said that she thinks that the royal family should be more normal. They should be more like us, like everyone else. And I said, then what's the point of them being the royal family if they're just like us? The whole point is that they are different from us. That didn't go down well. That didn't go down. Everyone else disagreed with me. Everyone else. But I knew I was right. And I knew I was fucking right. I mean, why the fuck would you want a royal family who are just normal? What the fuck is the point of that? It's ridiculous. So that was it. I knew I was right, but I also knew that there was no point in me. I said it, and then I thought, right, I'll just leave it because there's no point pushing this. No one agrees with me, so I'll just dig a hole for myself if I persist. Anyway, sometime later, a different topic came up, and I said, the only thing I valued from school that I still value from my school days is Shakespeare, the teaching of that woman that I mentioned earlier. And someone piped up saying, I don't think Shakespeare should be taught at school, because it's got nothing to do with getting a job. And this person is a very dull normie, as you would expect. Someone who says something like that is going to be a fucking dullard. And this person was a dullard. And the trouble is, I realized, well, you've all got jobs. I'm unemployed. So I can't say that learning about Shakespeare helped me to get a job. I can't make that argument. So what you're saying is actually I'm proving your point by being unemployed. So that was very awkward and embarrassing. But the trouble is, again, I knew I was right. I knew that I was right. But I could not possibly make the case. So again, I just had to admit defeat. And so what we had then, at the end of that was, a fallacious refutation of hierarchy in social terms with the royal family and in cultural terms with Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. A fallacious refutation of these two things.
It goes hand in hand. It's connected. It's the same mindset.
Exactly the same mindset, which is that everything is of equal value. Every person is of equal. Every person's opinion.
Everything
is of
should
equal value.
Be. Yeah, everything should also be of equal
and
value.
We should see these things as being of equal value. So there's nothing special about Shakespeare. There's no reason why Shakespeare should be especially taught at high school. And that someone else said, Shakespeare bored me at school. It was boring. This kind of stuff. And what I've come to accept years later is, they were correct in the sense that it was pointless teaching them Shakespeare because they're fucking dull. And I do have some bitterness towards them. I have some resentment. So I'll admit that. But I also accept that they are right, that it's just a waste of their time. But it wasn't a waste of my time. Even though it didn't help me get a job, it definitely was not a waste of my time to teach me Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet and The Merchant of Venice. And I think we touched on Hamlet as well. These things are precious. And I don't say it as an affectation. It's genuinely true that I value them very, very highly. They sort of reassure me about the capacity of people to create things that are meaningful. In the same way that a beautiful building does the same thing, like a really beautiful building does the same thing. And so, I mean, there's so many different things you could say about this, but the point is that for a thinking person, a high quality work of art or work of literature is reassuring because it means other people have done this. Life is meaningful. It is possible to create meaningful things. It is possible to create things that matter. It's not all just sludge. It's not all just meaningless. Now, for the people around me at that table, they didn't need that reassurance because they're just getting on with practical stuff, practical life. And to introduce them to high culture is to waste their time and to confuse them. And it does. Yeah. It does just confuse them. I accept this now. I do still resent them for being contemptuous of me and my interests, and for being so numerous in society so that they set the tone. I really resent them for that. Mm. I wish that they knew their place. But at the same time, and it's true, they really, like, people should know their place. But at the same time, it's also true that they are in some ways better people than me. They're better. They're more responsible. They're more punctual. they're less self-destructive. They're less angsty than me. And you know, no one at that table was a bad person. Dull, some of them, but not bad. Not a bad person. They would do the right thing, you know, so far as they saw it. So I don't mean to condemn them completely. I realize now the answer to this riddle is that different types of people should be educated separately in different schools. And that's the answer. And then, just as good fences make good neighbors, maybe I won't feel such fucking resentment towards them. And maybe they won't have such loathing for me and people like me, my ilk. Because otherwise, well, it's like multiculturalism, really. If you rub up against each other, you're just going to piss each other off. So that was a horrible experience, horrible. And it did, it made me doubt myself because I thought, well, they all have jobs. I'm unemployed. I'm a wreck. They're okay. So what good did Shakespeare do me, really?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a legitimate question. I think it does have some legitimacy to ask that. But anyway, as I say, the answer is it's just different strokes for different folks. And then the high should impose itself on the low. So just they're more numerous than us, but we should impose our rule over them so that they don't they don't say something stupid like a fucking stupid soap opera is just as good as Hamlet. You know, I want them to know not to say that. Don't say it out loud anyway. You know, keep it to your fucking self. And again, I do feel resentment. I'm sorry. I just do.
I can understand completely, and I find this story you have told it to me before very fascinating because it encapsulates so much. It's one of those stories which really creates a division because either you get it or you don't. You just are on one side. People who don't immediately get what happened inside you, what was happening here, they will never get it. And the thing is, you have an advantage over these people because of your non-egalitarian worldview. It makes you understand them. You can see they are different and they have different needs or different qualities or different qualifications. And you can only do that because you're anti-egalitarian. But they cannot understand you because they're egalitarian, because they think something like you or something like Shakespeareism shouldn't even exist. It's useless. They can't see anything but themselves in this thing. And what I see here is also a clash between, I mean, you know, there are old educational values which are still around like ghosts, and they date back, let's say, to the beginning of 20th century or 19th century, this idea that you can have high culture for everybody. This is what idealistic people who set up the school system thought of, that you can elevate even the working classes to Shakespeare. If you look at 19th century or early 20th century socialists, people like George Bernard Shaw or so, they were like that. They believed you could elevate the people, and they had an idea of elevation. They didn't think that, and probably at that time there was more openness or ambition among certain people, among the working classes, to get more educated or to get lifted up to a different level. But you have an idea there's a higher level, and then you already have some kind of hierarchy. But the thing is that these values, these educational values, they still persist in a way to say, ooh, kids should be taught about Shakespeare, about whatever reason. There's really no answer for it anymore. But the way mass society has developed and the values of mass society have overwhelmed this. So this is in conflict, and the values of mass society, of course, are going to win. And I remember also in my school, it was already this discussion. For example, we had in Austria, I think we still have it. We have two different types of high schools, Gymnasium it's called. And one was called Realgymnasium, and one was called, it had also an old German idealistic educational ideal, humanistic high school Gymnasium, which means you had a focus on, for example, Latin. You would learn Latin. I did have Latin school. You could learn Old Greek, Ancient Greek. You would learn literature. You would go into all these kind of things. You do not need to get a job. It was an educational ideal. And even back then, there was a sort of class idea going on that if you send children to this kind of school, you are aiming for something higher. You want them to become academics or such. And other kids would go to what we call Hauptschule. This would be the children who would not go into literature and Latin or so, not go to academia, but who would, you know, pick up normal regular jobs, and they wouldn't have school until they're 18. They would start when they're 15 or so. But within the high school system, there was a division already, and Realgymnasium, realistic, I don't know how to translate it, but this would focus more on technical things, on practical things. It would cut out all the Latin and Shakespeare crap to get people more into a practical life. And I remember when we had Latin at school, which was used to be an educational prestige. It used to be an educational prestige of upper classes, of more educated classes, that you know about this. I mean, you probably have seen this clip where Boris Johnson goes on to quote from the Iliad in ancient Greek. Have you seen it?
Yes. It's the same.
And he goes on and on and on and on, and he just has a big show off, for what a great classical education he has got. And it's a class thing. And it was still around back when I was there, but already the standards for admission were lowered. They used to have tests whether you are even qualified to go to that gymnasium. But they were lowered and lowered because they didn't want to offend people. They got more and more egalitarian. And also within the humanist branch of the gymnasium, they would discuss, why do we need Latin? Then you would say, hey, Latin is the basis for so many languages like French, Italian, and Spanish and others. If you get Latin, you have the basis and you will learn this easily. So you would have a practical justification, but you didn't have this justification where you got to read the classical authors. You got to read Tacitus and Cicero and Horaz, and you get to know about Homer when you taught ancient Greek. The classical idea was still there, but it was losing ground. It was losing legitimacy, right? And probably today it's completely replaced, almost completely replaced by some wokery going on, as I could see in my gymnasium, which is also some sort of idea. It's not an idealistic idea. It's not something that...
But it's a thought-terminating idea. It's not like classical mentality. It's very ideological. Yes, and it cannot brook any disagreement. I mean, you will not get an ethics class at that school where they question, should homosexuality be promoted in society?
Or where you open your... or where you discuss eugenics. Where you get really into an inquiry. This is actually what you're supposed to do. When you study the classical authors, it's supposed to make you think. It's supposed to make you understand. It's supposed to make you a grip. Where is all this coming from? What was the basis? And this has deteriorated in a way. And today,
just over the last 30 years, it's very, very visible.
The thing is, if you get this kind of woke brainwashing, it does help you get a job today, because you need to have the right attitude. You need to use the right keywords to get on in society and to get useless jobs, or even not useless jobs. Even if you do something practical, the company wants from you to subscribe to diversity values. So in a way, by this brainwashing, they are prepared for a practical life, but they stop thinking.
Yeah, it's a completely different thing. It's a completely different attitude to what education is for. And I see what you mean. I understand what you're saying, that it started with this idea, end of the 19th century, start of the 20th, that we can give everyone a high culture. So then you try to do that, but you realize you have to keep lowering the standard in order to bring everyone to that. And then eventually you just start hollowing out the curriculum, and you start say, well, why is Shakespeare higher than... some modern equivalent. And there is no real answer, because all of the framework by which you would make that decision has been eroded. And at any rate, you can no longer afford to say that Shakespeare is better than some modern author, because that means you're affirming hierarchy. So, so egalitarian, I mean, it's like acid, you know, just melts everything. It just dissolves everything, unless it's actively fought against, unless it's actively explicitly rejected. So that's what's happened, really.
Because it never stops anywhere. I think Tocqueville was it who said that equality is like a fire that needs more and more things to burn and consume. It has no limits. It always looks for more and more limits.
Yes, and that's what's happened. The worst thing about all of this, well, one of the worst things, is the dishonesty that it makes necessary, because everyone knows that there is high and low. Everyone knows that there is better and worse. And everyone wants to be the cleverest. You know, anyone who says, I don't believe in intelligence, I don't care about this, they actually really do care that their kid is cleverer than the next door neighbor's kid. Everyone wants that. And I remember saying this kind of bullshit as an adolescent. Like, I don't believe in standards and so on. But I wanted to get an A.
Sure.
I mean, when I didn't get an A when I failed, I got an E in maths, and I was kind of humiliated by it. I mean, I deserved it, but. It was that gives the lie to the whole thing. This is something that I don't know how people sustain this hypocrisy. They must just have no self-reflection. They must just not look at their own decision making, their own preferences. So they'll say that, well, everything's equal, but I want the best. That's a blatant contradiction. And it really matters. It you're showing with this decision that this statement you made is complete shite. You don't actually believe this. So, yeah, as I say, I think the only way they can sustain this is by never examining themselves.
Even back then, when I was in gymnasium in the 90s, I told you, they were lowering the standards because one thing was happening, that people wanted to have the prestige of having sent their kids to that school without the work that you, or the ability you had to have before. So this is how it became hollow. You know, it became just the surface. You went to gymnasium, you got your matura, but it didn't matter as much. It mattered 10 years or 20 years or so ago, because it was easier to get. And I must say, I, for my part, I have never, ever been an egalitarian because I was too brilliant. I wanted to be better. I was also lazy, but things came easy to me. And I remember I was passionately interested in literature, in German literature at that time. This is why my teacher, the conservative teacher, the female teacher, loved me, also the other one. And I could see what I would write about the books we discussed would really have a meaning for myself. I didn't do it because I was forced to. There were others in the class, they were forced to. And some of them did well. They did exactly what was expected for them. They got the same A grade as I did, the same as I did. But I knew that mine was so much more worth. On paper, we had the same grade. Yeah. But they were just the ones who were busybodies, who were just doing fine. But I was the one who really got it, the one to whom it really mattered beyond school. Because I was reading these books even without school. The school didn't force me to read these books because I already started reading them. I read Kafka age 12 because I like to. Huh? I want to brag or anything, but this is the way it was.
I read The Shining age 12 and it was too much.
I read Stephen King age 11. It was way too much for me. It was
400 pages. The Shining was 400 right. pages. It was too much.
Yeah, I read Pet Sematary, but I shouldn't have. It just fucked me up. But listen, but what I want to say is that even back then, I felt something was going on. Something was wrong with lowering the standards. And I started feeling resentment about, I didn't want to be the best. It wasn't about me. Of course, to some extent, it's always about you. And the people who resent quality standards, it's also about them. It's narcissistic problems. Everybody of us has this kind of narcissistic problems, ego problems and so. But there's a difference. It mattered to me what it was about. And there was this odd thing already happening that the teachers would pretend that they were doing something good for us, by lowering the standards, by being less authoritarian, by making us do things by ourselves and so. And I felt it was wrong. You know, I felt it was absolutely wrong. And what happened to me is it took out all my motivation because it didn't matter. It was boring to me. I mean, to me, it was better if I got some pressure, if I got a challenge. And the new progressive ideas were, don't put too much challenge on them. Just let it go slowly, slowly, slowly. And it would help the mediocre ones, but it would harm the talented ones. I would consider myself a talented one. Yeah. So I was happy for teachers who would put the challenge on me, but I had to go to the special group, you know, with that German leftist teacher to get the challenge. And at least it was there. At least there was an idea there that somebody could get into a group with more challenge if he decides to.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that engages you. It challenges you. You've got to care about it. Otherwise, you're going to fail. So, of course, it's exciting. I completely understand it. But, of course, as you say, thank God that special class was available. Otherwise, you would have just been been surrounded by mediocrity, and it wouldn't have engaged you, it wouldn't have interested you, and you would just be demoralized. So yeah, I completely understand. I mean, it's a signal that they can ascend, that you don't have to try, and that just makes you switch off.
Yeah, and listen, we have been going for more than 3 hours now. We could go forever.
I wanted it to be the longest one. When I saw it, we were at 2.5 hours. I thought, oh, we could make it the longest one this year. That'd be good.
Are we already?
We have done it.
We are. Yeah. So because it fits, because I had prepared something which I didn't, but it fits so very well. Let's go to the end and let me say a few words about a book I recently reread, which deals very much with what we are talking about now. Yeah? And this is Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, this famous dystopian novel from the 1950s. And it does, I have to mention, it does have a special meaning in the right-wing sphere because it had been established as a sort of cult novel for a long time now. One example is, for example, the Casa Pound in Italy. They have this house occupied, you know, and they had another one, which is called Casa Montag. And it's named after the main character of that novel, Guy Montag. Montag in German means just Monday. And it has been more than 10 years that the book and also images from the film have been sort of iconized within our new right circles. I have one example here. This is a notebook published by Antaios. You see here, it has Oscar Werner from the film version from 1966. You have a box of matches, and the Fahrenheit 451 is the degree where paper starts to burn.
Huh? Right. Yes.
This is the idea of it. And the story of it is, and I have to mention it. I have to give a little shout out here. There is an activist group in Vienna at the university now, which call themselves Action 451. They have made up these lovely stickers. Maybe you can zoom in so people can see.
Oh, hold on a second.
It.
I'll do that again. Hold on.
Yeah.
So is this a leftist group?
But you cannot really see it here. Sorry. But it's an image of Montag, the fireman from the book, and it says a book is a weapon. And there's a line from the book: the book in the house next door is like a loaded gun. And it's a sort of activist group at the university, New Right identitarian group, and they have also other stickers here which are funny. They are nice. Here's one with Schopenhauer and one with Nietzsche and one with Martin Heidegger. So their plan is to have these stickers all over university and to create a right-wing activist group on the university under that name, Action 451. And the novel, and we cannot go too deeply into that because we already have talked a lot, but you know, the novel is set up in a future where the fireman, the job is not to save houses from burning. There's a method that made houses fireproof, but to find people who store books and destroy the books. Their job is to burn books because this is part of that regime. It doesn't want any books around anymore. And the regime works by having people covered with screens all the time, which is basically what's happening now. But in the book and in the film, the book is from early 50s. So people live in these houses and they have big TV screens surrounding them. And they are being flooded with bullshit. They are being flooded with silly, stupid entertainment. And they are kept in a stage of perpetual superficial happiness with drugs and TV in a way. And this main character, Guy Montag, he's a fireman in this brigade. And he's a guy who starts to question what's happening. He gets interested. He sometimes gets a book and he says, let's look what's in it. And he starts collecting these books and reading them. And he starts to change his mind. And now in the novel, there's a very scary character, so to speak, and it's a robot dog, an artificial dog. And this dog can sniff whether you have changed your mind, because the chemicals inside you change. If your thinking changes, the chemical composition of you changes, and the dog can sniff it. And the dog who is at the fire station, he gets increasingly aggressive towards Montag, because that robot dog can sniff something's going on with him. And eventually Montag, he meets a young girl next door. They have a platonic friendship set up, and this girl is different. She asks questions he never thought of. The main thing is that she actually can see what's happening around herself. She asks questions about it. She doesn't want to know how people are doing things, but why. She also wants to know why. Yeah? And the regime always teaches people to do things, but never why. Yeah? And eventually, he has a traumatic experience. They find a house where there's a huge library in it. And there's a woman who owns the library. And in one scene, I mean, she just pours kerosene all over herself and she lights the match herself. And she decides to go up in flames with her books, to die, rather die with her books. Yeah. And in the film, it's also a very impressive scene. It's a great film with the Austrian actor Oskar Werner, who was one of our greatest actors, a very, you know, handsome, impressive man with a magnificent voice. And this is the last for him. Yeah. And eventually this girl next door, who also made him think, she suddenly disappears overnight. Her whole family disappears. And later on, he learns they are dead. They have been deported. They have been killed by the regime. And now Montag, he has a chief commander. He's called Beatty, like Warren Beatty or so. And he noticed this man, he knows about history. History has all been but erased or simplified, like in Orwell in that point. And he knows about books. And he realizes something's going on with Montag. And then there's a fascinating scene in the book where this commander visits Montag back home, who has sick leave. He's sick. He doesn't want to go anymore, but he feels sick. And he pays him a visit back home. He knocks on his door. And then he has a speech to explain to him why the regime is doing what it's doing. And recently I had a stream with Martin Sellner, why I read the entire passage, which we don't have the time to do now, the entire passage, the speech of Beatty, which is interesting, because he says the following thing. He says, first of all, these books are no use because they contradict each other. Each book says something different. This is only confusing people. The next thing is that the regime de-emphasizes having genuine emotions. You only have to have fake emotions, but the books, they stir emotions, they reflect emotions, they describe emotions. Thinking makes you have emotions. This is bad. And then he goes on to say that the books also offend each other. And then he goes on a list of minorities that get offended by books, which is interesting because this is early 1950s. Today we are at this situation, yeah, where you say you have to ban books because there are things inside it that might offend this or this minority. And he explains we have this society, and basically some sort of America in the future. Yeah? And America in 1951 was far less diverse than today. But he goes on to say, yes, we I don't know, we have Jews and Christians and Italians and Swedes and Blacks and all these people. Everybody can take offense if you say something, and they have to be peaceful. They have to be kept quiet. So if there's a book that the whites don't like, we burn it. If there's a book the blacks don't like, we burn it. So they have in peace together. Huh? So this already predates the woke culture, the culture of taking no offense anywhere. But he goes on to another more in deeper going explanation. He says, listen, literature in old times used to be something for elites, especially before printing was invented. It was educated elites who wrote, possessed, and understood books. And this was high culture. If you look at it, This is actually what we remember if we talk about Elizabethan culture from the Shakespeare, De Vere times. We talk about the high culture of the educated people. And often this culture would cross the boundaries. For example, Shakespeare plays could be very popular among lower classes. It would be played in theaters and it would be watched by the court and by the lower classes, people alike. But the people who were able to write them, or the people who were ready to perform them, they had to be more educated. They had to read. And at that time, printing was already invented. And he said, and then printing became a mass thing. Mass society rose up. And then you would suddenly start printing things for mere entertainment, for entertainment for the masses. You would make the classics understandable for the masses. Then you would have Reader's Digest. You would have a Reader's Digest of Hamlet and a Reader's Digest of the Reader's Digest of Hamlet. And more it would flatten. You would get very condensed versions of the classics. This is what we talked about before, that you have an educational ideal, which comes from up on high. But the more mass society progresses, the more you have to flatten it. So people still have a certain respect for Shakespeare or Goethe or high culture, but they don't get it as much anymore the more mass culture progresses. And so Captain Beatty, he says, and at this point, it was pointless. The classics were flattened. They were just mass project. There was too much of everything. And it was shallow. So why not just do it away? Everything, right? And just create a peaceful, homogeneous society. Everybody's attached to a screen and don't have these damn books anymore, right? And of course, this doesn't convince Montag. And he eventually happens to find an old man he met somewhere in a park who is still of the old school, who knows about books. And at one point, Montag, he obtains a copy of a Bible. And he calls this man, ask how many Bibles are still there in the world. He says, probably they are all gone. This is the last Bible existing. And this is like a treasure. And so he visits that old man. The old man is first a bit suspicious. And then he opens up, he sees Montag is sincere, and he explained to him a thing. He says, in fact, you think it's the books, but it's not the books. It's what's inside the books, the memory that is stored in the books. And it can also be, he mentions, an old record, an old film, an old friend. Things that are remembered and ways to remember things. This is the one thing you are looking for. And then he also discusses about the rank a book has in a hierarchy. He says, not books all the same. Some books are more complex. Some books are simple. Some books are stupid. Not books are all the same. Some books probably are not necessary at all. And Montag realizes he's one of those people who gets it. Right. And eventually in the course of the book, he will escape into a forest. And in the film, it's very beautifully done. There's this group of book people and they memorize their favorite book. Yeah? They become the books. The books are not printed on paper. It's memorized like they used to do in ancient days before the Odyssey or the Iliad was written down. It was memorized. Right. And the books are being passed on from generation to generation. And so in the end, you see Montag in the film, he's memorizing a book. He's becoming a book person. And the thing is, it ties very neatly to what we discussed, that this is an elitist group. It's not for everybody. So Captain Beatty, in a way, is right. This is what makes it so interesting, that some things he's saying, this functionary of the regime, are right. What he says about mass society, how it works, how it gets together, is in many ways correct. But the way he supports it would also mean eradicating this kind of elite that is different, that is not stupid and superficial, that has a soul, so to speak, a soul that is still left. And this is what I find absolutely amazing. I mean, I had read the book many years ago and I knew the film, but when I reread it, it was stunning. I realized this is a book for us. This is really a book that is now for grabs, for right-wingers to sort of adopt and say, this is our kind of book now. And I see. I wanted to tell this story. I had it prepared to talk about that and about Action 451. Then we went into different territories. But now I see it ties up very neatly. We end up at this thing again. And after there was Kubitschek. I mentioned this. Kubitschek was in Vienna a month ago, and he was supposed to have a speech about the novel at university. It was arranged by the Freedom Party Youth Organization. The university would forbid it. There would be a protest, blah, blah, blah. And Kubitschek would have the speech in a private setting. You know, I mean, it was a setting where the right-wing people came in. And it was a great speech. It was a very subtle speech. Very subtle speech. He went into the book about the problems it supposes. And after he had the speech, I was supposed to lead a discussion with the audience. And the first thing I asked the audience was, so who of you has ever burned a book? And three hands were raised and asked, what did you burn? And one woman said, I burned a Quran in the back of my garden. I said, why did you do it? Just because I hated it. So it was for her personal hygiene. One burned a book by Karl Marx, and one burned a school book he hated, right? And I ask you this provocative question because I mentioned, in fact, because books have a rank in a hierarchy, there are many books I would gladly burn. I have no problem. I would destroy them because there's so much trash being printed. Wood, paper, forests are cut down to print shit, to put children's books that brainwash them into LGBTQ shit. This is poison. I'd burn it instantly, right? I'd decide to burn it instantly. I'm a big lover of books. I have a huge library. I'm a bibliophile. I'm a book hoarder. But there are lots of books I would gladly burn. I had no problem with it, you know. And some books I would save, store for an elite to preserve, to know what some parts of the past were, you know. So I wouldn't destroy them completely. I would reserve who would read it, you know. Only elite could read it. So there we are again at the elitist argument. And I, for my part, I did burn a few books, I confess, but they were just shit books. It was for a film I made for Secession, where I had a poster with this guy on, and I had the books burned in front of the poster, and I had the poster burned. So I did it, but it was for artistic purpose. Also, that's my final story for today about that novel, and I encourage everybody to read it because it's terrific, absolutely terrific.
Oh, fantastic. There are so many things along the way that occurred to me to say, but now I've forgotten them all. So I'm sorry, but I do take the point that really the solution is separation. The solution is the
hierarchy, elitism, and separation. As it was for the most part of history. Mass culture destroyed it all. But I think even within mass culture, you could have it if you wanted. You know, you could say one thing is for the masses.
It would have to be artificially maintained, imposed.
Yeah.
You'd still have it in mass culture, but it wouldn't come naturally. It would go against the grain. So you'd have to really insist. Here's why we're doing this. Here's why those kids go to a different school. Here's why this is taught at that school. Here's why that matters, and therefore we teach this at that school, and so on. You'd have to justify because otherwise the plebs would rise up.
Because it's good for these particular kids, and for other kids, other things are good. And then it's fine. I mean, I don't know. But this only goes if you're... I think you can only be just if you are not egalitarian. This is, I think, the fallacy of egalitarians. You think egalitarianism is justice. What does it mean? It doesn't. It's wrong. On the contrary, like William Blake said, one law for the ox and the lion is not working. It's a crime against nature.
Of course. Now the idea that egalitarianism is justice. Or equality is justice. No, not at all. I just don't see that.
On the contrary. I think, I mean, on the contrary, another inversion. It's an inversion.
Yeah, it is. Hmm. I mean, I think it's one thing to want people, everyone, to be treated respectfully. That's one thing. But that's not the same as thinking everyone is of equal value or everyone is the same. And indeed, I think when you try to think of them like that, you're actually disrespecting everyone. So it's actually a stupid thing it's a stupid attitude to take. You're insulting the higher, and you're placing too much pressure on the lower. So it's just a tone deaf thing to do. I completely agree. As I say, I think a lot of the resentment that I feel, it's interesting because as I was telling that story earlier, I realized that I really do have a lot of resentment. And I think that cannot be healthy. It can't be right. And I'll have to think about it and try to work that out and try to exercise it, because I don't want to be like that. I think it's because they have the upper hand and they just shouldn't.
Yeah.
I think that's where it makes me feel this way.
I mean, resentment is natural. But, you know, for Nietzsche, the guy I wrote, which didn't please my leftist teacher, but one of the most important things in Nietzsche is the overcoming of resentment. He said resentment is the worst thing. I mean, for him, I mean, Nietzsche believed very much in hierarchy, you know, in the noble, in the special, in the, you know, what is above. But he also believed that overcoming resentment was extremely important. And he saw resentment working in egalitarianism. He thought the root of egalitarianism is resentment. And it's just natural that you would react with counter-resentment against that, right? So this is a natural reaction, but resentment tends to...
Yeah, when you hear someone saying that Shakespeare is pointless, I mean, how can you not resent them for saying that? I know... Sure. Maybe the responsible thing is for me to say, well, of course she's going to say that. Mm. She's this kind of person. Mm-hmm. And I should be sanguine. I should be calm about this. But the way I actually feel is, who the fuck are you to say that? I feel anger.
Yeah. Of course. I think there are two kinds of resentment here. I mean, one also, of course, I mean, at that point you were in a weak position because they were successful, they were employed, you were unemployed, you were sort of the loser. Your argument for Shakespeare wouldn't weigh much because of that. And of course, I mean, it would also be natural to have a resentment against those people who are more practical, more successful, more vital, who don't have to deal with, I don't know, depressions or other kind of things that thoughtful people have. But it's human to have this kind of feeling, but this is the bad kind of resentment, because it's all about your ego and about your personal feelings of, you know, inferiority. And so this is something you have to overcome. But when it's about the thing itself, which you think has value, the Shakespeare has value, this is different, because then it's not about you. It's about a thing you recognize as being valuable.
Yes, it's about protecting the rare and valuable and precious.
Yes,
and
yes.
As I say, the solution, the only way to do that is to believe in hierarchy and to impose it on the masses. Otherwise, they will destroy things like Shakespeare. They just will.
They do.
Because they don't understand it. They don't understand it, and they know they don't understand it. And rather than admit that it's beyond them, it's much easier for them to just say, well, it's crap, it's pointless. That's why I don't understand it, because it's crap. And then you've just got anarchy. You've just, you know, they'll just burn the whole city down.
This is the argument of Captain Beatty in Fahrenheit novel. He says the masses wouldn't understand it anyway. They dragged it down, they made it more and more shallow. So why keep it up anyway? Yeah, just let it go, and it's done, and it doesn't cause anything good anyway.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, Martin, and thank you for doing it. I should say that there are some super chats, but we can get to a few.
Yeah, okay. Shall we go through them?
Yes. Well, I've got to. I mean, you can.
People stick out that long, and I don't know if ever. Yeah, let's go. Let's do it.
Okay. The first one was actually 3 hours ago. In fact, most of them were. Sorry.
They're already asleep.
I didn't think the stream would go on this long, so I thought it's safe to leave them to the end like I normally do. Because I think the last time Lichtmess was on, we talked for an hour and a half or 2 hours. So I didn't realize we'd be talking for this long. Anyway, so this was I'm Still Denise, Angerad Celtic. And she's a very loyal fan of mine. And she also loves you, Lichtmess. And she said, my favorite guest on Millennial. Love to you both. So she always is very enthusiastic about your appearances on Millennial. So thank you, Denise.
Thank you.
And then the kids are all right. Alt-Right said something. Beware of subversive influence. Yes, indeed. Thin Red Line. Happy New Year to all the German lands, including Austria. Oh, thank you, Thin Red Line. And then Armchair Limerick Nationalist. Oh, he asks, what do you think was the entire objective of the COVID hoax and what will be the outcome of it? That's interesting. What do you think the objective of that whole thing was in retrospect?
Oh, God. Well, we would need another hour, but I don't think there was an objective in such a way that there was already an intended outcome. They say, we do this because we want to get there. So I'd rather adopt a view of my friend Eugypius, which you had on your show. So I suggest go to this discussion. This is more the way I see it.
All right. I don't think I agree. I think it happened for a reason. I don't think it just came out of nowhere. I think his idea is that the virus emerged and a bunch of systems kicked into gear, came into action. And sort of just made the whole reaction happen. So with lockdowns and all that, I don't believe that. I've got to say, I disagree with you, Eugypius, on this. I dare say it happens, but I think with COVID, there was a driving force. Otherwise, it simply wouldn't have happened. I just don't think it would have happened. I think that our health systems aren't that paranoid. They're not that oversensitive. I think the point was to prepare people for the Great Reset, and I think that that's a whole other thing. Yeah. But do you have something to say?
Maybe you are right. The thing is, I don't know. I can give a definite answer. I think the structural explanation makes more sense to me. Because I think what was called the Great Reset is something that had other names before, and it's sort of a much longer process, which has a dynamics of its own. And it certainly speed up, accelerated a lot during COVID. And I'm not sure whether this was set up on purpose to say, we set this up now to speed up the process. Let's say, I don't know. So there were times when I believed this strongly, especially when it happened, that this must have been set up just to have this goal, you know, to speed up this process, what they call the Great Reset. But I must say, I'm not so sure anymore.
So I'm not saying that the virus was deliberately engineered and released in order to do this. I wouldn't be surprised if that part of it was an accident. But I think once it was out there, they realized, okay, this is our opportunity. And that was probably going on in January, February.
Well, okay. True. This is much what they said themselves. I mean, there was this preposterous book by Klaus Schwab and that other guy released, I think, in June 2020 or so. And it pretty much said it, that it said this is a great opportunity now to have a change, as they say it, as they want to have it happen. Well, I guess we're not so far away with our views here. It's a question of nuances.
Yeah, exactly. We'll probably never know. But yeah, as you say, they were pretty much saying this stuff at the time. I remember people from the UN and the EU saying, now is an opportunity to rebuild and rebalance our economy so that it's...
Build
more...
back better, remember?
All of that.
Every leader on the whole planet parroted this. We need to build back better. So everybody was like, the line was scripted for each of them.
Oh yeah,
and they were still gaslighting us by saying, "Oh, Great Reset is a conspiracy theory." There was end of 2020, I think, a Time magazine cover, "The Great Reset," you know, and would explain. I mean, it was hard for them to explain what the difference was between what they said they wanted to do and between what the conspiracy theory was. I mean, it's similar with the Great Replacement. You know? I mean, they also openly say what they want to do, but if we say it, it's a conspiracy theory. So you get gaslighted about it.
God, what a fucking world we live in! Yeah, all right. Yeah, exactly. They say it, and then if we say it, then we're crazy. Fucking hell! I mean, it's like an abusive relationship. It's the cliche of the abusive partner.
Fuck yeah, sake. It is. And these people probably, I mean, I don't know if they are sociopaths or on a personal level, but they act in a sort of collective sociopathy towards the rest of the world. And this is why we are in this codependent, abusive relationship with them, except for us of them who have canceled this relationship.
Yeah, exactly. Someone's pointed out that Event 201 was in the October of 2019. That's true, but then Keith Woods did make a good point about that, which was that they actually do lots of those kinds of events, the drills. And, you know, that one wasn't unique. They do lots of things, so why would that one be particular? But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Because it was very close.
Exactly.
I mean, it was just 2 months ahead before it happened. But there are also differences. I mean, UGPs talked a lot about that. For example, they had not lockdowns in that one. The lockdowns really were an invention of these early days. And it's still quite complicated how this came to pass. But, you know, this will take another hour to talk about. So.
Yeah, I know. Okay, and then... I'm Still Denise also said, "I think I want to go to Vienna and taunt and torment mask slaves with Lichtmess." I will egg him on.
Okay, so Denise, if you come to Vienna, just contact me. I don't know.
Okay.
How should she be able to? She's just right.
I can put you in touch.
And then we hang out and we torment these guys together. Because I'm too shy all by myself. I need some woman to push me, you know, to encourage me. And say,
it doesn't
come
sound
on,
like
please,
you
please,
are
please.
Shy. I mean, you've had several of these experiences.
I'm just joking. Yeah, but I'm shying away of attacking these people now, even though I feel like it. Just this one guy in the shop annoyed me so much, I just had at least to get a bit sarcastic, saying, "Oh, the numbers have risen again. Oh, interesting. Oh, you don't want to get sick. Why? So just playing dumb to confuse him.
Oh, dear. Anyway, and then Thin Red Line says, "Do you know the bands DAF and Grauzone, and what do you think of them?"
Well, Grauzone is, of course, Ice Bear, you know?
Oh, of course. I know that. I like that song. Yes.
And DAF is Deutsch-Amerikanische Freundschaft. Amazing band. They had the song Der Mussolini.
Yes, I thought so, yeah.
Yeah. So Verschwende Deine Jugend and all this kind of stuff.
I often say,
I love them.
When,
yeah.
when I went to Amsterdam in 2001, it was the last time I was abroad before 9/11, and it was my first time in Amsterdam. It's a quite different city then. It was more Dutch, you know, it was less of a, it wasn't a global city in the way that we now know London and Berlin and Amsterdam to be. It was more Dutch back then. But anyway, I went into a record store, because in those days you went into record stores, and I got this double CD called Club Wave. And it was a double album of electronic dance music from the 80s and early 90s. It was so fucking good. It introduced me to so many. I think I was, 18, 19, and it introduced me to so many bands that I'd never heard of before. It was sort of Italo disco, house music, European dance stuff from the 80s. It's fucking great. And one of the bands was DAF. It had Der Mussolini on it. There were so many, like Propaganda, P Machinery. Bostich by Yellow. I won't list them all now, but so many good bands on that.
I like all this stuff.
And it's like, this is what could happen back in those days. You'd walk into a record store, I think it was a secondhand place, and just flick through what they had, and you might well find something that, you know, is terrific. That happened again in Edinburgh a few years before that. With an ambient album that I got called Modernity by a Norwegian group. I think they were Norwegian. And it's fucking terrific. And again, it was just a chance purchase. It cost £4. I had £4, so I bought it. And it's one of the best things I've ever encountered, actually. It sounds ridiculous to say that, but it's one of the things that means the most to me, is this thing that I just happened upon by chance.
Yeah, you see, this is what I said about the pleasures of the pre-digital age. This is the discoveries you made today. The YouTube algorithms, they will show you what you might like, and it's kind of helpful, I find stuff, but the pleasure of just discovering something randomly in a record store, and you don't know what's in it, and you put it on back home and you discover something is just gone. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I found Modernity on the internet. So I'm going to, it's by a band called Neural Network, and there it is. It's just fantastic. If people want to buy it, it's ambient, mid 90s ambient. Mm. And it's fucking gorgeous. So anyway, all right. Well, I think those are all the super chats. So thank you to everyone for sending those in. I'll just check here. So someone said, enjoyed, this is from Stan, enjoyed Millennial this year. I'm sure it is a lot of work for you, but many appreciate it. Looking forward to next year's Yule. Happy New Year 2024. Well, thank you very much, Stan. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. It's not quite over yet. We have the Morgoth stream tomorrow, and then the outro AME. Is there another one? Am I forgetting anything? No, that's it. So, yeah, two more streams. The outro AME might be right after the Morgoth stream. It depends how long that one goes on. I'm not sure, because otherwise it's going to be on New Year's Eve. And I like the idea of Millennial being over within the year, like within the, before New Year's Eve comes along. I prefer that, because it feels like, you know, it's something for the Christmas season. And then the new year is a new start. And yeah, anyway, we'll see. It might have to be that way this year. All right. Well, this has been great, Lichtmess. So thank you very much for doing this. As I said, I didn't intend it to go on this long, but we've both had an awful lot to say. So I hope it's been interesting for people to listen to. All right.
Yeah. Thank you much. Thank you very much for having me on again. It was a pleasure as always. We got carried away. And we are a good team, because, you know, we talk all the time. So you and me almost every day. So we are sort of, you know each other.
This is why
we can go on and on.
I don't know how obvious that is. I'm interested in how obvious that is to people watching. Is it obvious that Lichtmess and I talk pretty much all the time? Or do we come across as kind of strangers to each other? Let me know. But yeah, we are good chums. All right.
The odd couple.
Yes. Okay, well, it's been very fun. So I'll be back tomorrow night. But in the meantime, Martin Lichtmess. Oh, and go and subscribe to his Telegram, and he's got a Substack now as well. So go and look at those. Mm. Martin Lichtmess, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023. Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bidding on this year's NFT ends on the 30th. It's your chance to own this one-of-a-kind commemorative piece, lovingly hand-coded by Millennial Woes himself.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.